Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, another Saturday night bringing it to you, Morelia Python's Radio. What's going on, Owen?
Nothing so far. We are hanging in there just trying to get the 2012 season up off the ground. And I'm looking forward to just relaxing from my Saturday night right now, kicking back, talking carpet pythons. So,
okay. And we have a special guest tonight. We have Sean Christian from Morelia Pythons Forum, probably the best Morelia forum that around on the net. I mean, if you're into carpet pythons, that's pretty much the place to be. So, looking forward to talking to Sean. Should be a good show.
Definitely interesting.
Well, it's official now. I am officially addicted to this hobby because I hatched out my first clutch the other day.
And like Sean said before we went onto the show, it's a little late in the game for you to figuring out that you're just addicted, being that, number one, you started your own company breeding them, you have so many, and now we have the radio show.
It's true.
A little late there, buddy. But congratulations on you hatching out your first clutch of eggs,
yep.
Even though she did it for you.
That's true.
It's awesome.
11 eggs, 100% hatch rate. So
nice.
They all look nice and healthy. And there's a couple in there that look like they could be holdbacks, very light in color. So should be cool.
Yeah. So now the true war begins, because now you have to get them eating, and now you have to get them growing, and now you got to make sure everything's all good. Be prepared for, why won't you eat? You're a baby carpet python. You need this food to live. Why won't you eat it? So, you'll be talking to them. You'll be yelling at them. Times you'll have to just close the cage and be like, all right, I'm going to come back to this one later, because right now, So.
Well, we'll set to see, because I have the clutch that's artificial incubation and one that's maternal incubation, so we'll have to see which one feeds better.
You're 50-50 right now.
I
apologize for what I did to you earlier this week. You sent the text of your baby RNJ is hatching to me and Luke Snell at the same time, and it's like, maternal incubation success. And I know you must have been, high as a kite, all bounced around, so happy. I had to knock you down a few pegs by sending you a picture of your eggs in my incubator saying, maternal incubation failure.
That was good. I got a chuckle
Luke got a kick out of that one, too, and I did post it on Facebook as well. So you're tagged in that picture if you haven't noticed it yet. But
I didn't, but that's pretty pretty good. I'll have to look it up. Oh, man.
I had to. It was to, you know, bring you back down to earth, buddy. It's, you know.
That's why we love you so much, Owen.
It's like when you're talking with, when we're talking with Will Bird, and you're like, oh, we're going to set up a herpetological society. I'm like, we are? I mean, how are we doing that? So.
Yeah, I have big dreams, my friend, big dreams.
I'm noticing. Just
oh,
not being
man.
Old immediately. But, no,
yeah,
it's definitely very good.
Yeah, and I guess the only other thing that I have going on is, you know, the Carmel Zebra, it's, like I said, didn't take with the Red Tiger. So I pulled him out. But then I figured I was curious to see what the Citrus Tiger would look like with the Red Tiger. So I threw them together, and sure enough, they were locking all this week. So
who knows?
I know. We'll see.
It's always good, in my opinion, to have a couple boys in your collection that are – maybe not the stellar morph that you want to create, but will go to bat for you when you need them. I mean, my one male before he passed away, Thorn, was just a normal lesser tiger. But
uh-huh.
You throw in a piece of rope and kind of wiggle it, he's like, I'll breed with that. Sure. So, I mean, when you needed him, he was very good.
Right.
So right now it's like my icon male Pyro is kind of taking his place. Where it's like I put him in with a girl, he's like, eh. So this way you can at least try to get salvage a season every year and there with a female if she doesn't like the jag or the boy that you put in there with him, with her, that would make really nice looking ones. Sometimes she just wants to make the ugly $40 worth of babies.
True story.
Hurts my feelings.
I want to send a special thanks out to Luke because he sort of, you know, once I got the eggs, then I was asking him, do I cut them because the one pipped out? Do I take it away from the mom? You know, what do I do? And he kind of walked me through that, so that was pretty cool. I pulled pulled her off, which she's
mm-hmm.
a feisty one. Good Lord.
Well, yeah, you're taking the babies. You expect me to be like, okay. I mean, no, they're always going to fight you a little bit.
Yeah, and did I lose my microphone? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. My computer said no microphone detected. That made me nervous for a minute.
Yeah, other people may not hear you. I could just be talking to myself right now. We won't know till later. Let's just keep going.
Okay. So I was saying that I pulled her off, washed her down, and washed the cage all out, washed everything in
yep.
the cage, put
yep.
her back. And she, you know, she was kind of searching around, I guess, still looking for her her eggs.
Yeah.
I pulled the eggs off. I put them in a, you know, Luke was telling me that he usually throws them in the incubator, but, you know, since I'm incubator-less, I just put them in a tub. With some paper towels, kept it moist in there, and threw it in my rack, and you know, waited till they hatched out. And I guess they started on the 8th, and now there's about 6 left to, you know, all their heads are out, but they're not out of the egg yet.
Right, that takes a while. It can take a few days.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I got a question for you, since you're a pro at this. As they're coming out of the egg, are you sexing them and setting them up right in the tubs right away, or how are you breaking that down?
What I do is I sex immediately just because it helps. They're so tiny and so kind of, I guess, weak that it's really easy and it doesn't even take that long to just kind of like, you know, boop, it's a boy, and then, you know, or it's a girl, and then you put it. I have these, you've seen them, my small Nidorrhoetischa cages.
Uh-huh. Right.
3 locks. I usually put a bunch of damp paper towels and a big water dish in there. And I'll put boys in one cage and girls in another cage. Now, this has worked out for me only because I haven't had multiple clutches hatching at the same time. This year, it seems all my girls want to just put them all on the ground at the same time. So they're all getting close to doing it and just going to drive me crazy. So I usually will put them in there for a few days.
Okay.
So, you know, there are usually some that are nice and fat. They're kind of all wiggling around. And then after that, I'll probably about a week or so, I'll set them up in my baby rack, and that's when they get their, you know, their numbers, and I assign boy, like, to put all of them in their cubs and give them their feed cards, and that's when they're ready to go. Here we go. We're starting. So that's
okay.
What I usually do.
Okay. Cool. What's going on over there at your place?
Almost forgot. My big girl had her prelay shed today.
Okay.
So, yeah, and she got an eye cap today.
Uh-oh.
And that was the worst experience of my life. Because she's like, you know, 9 foot and
yeah.
Pregnant and
oh, this
I'm
is your big
pulling
big
at her eye. And she's, so she's
gotcha.
Constricting me. She's like, all right, this ain't going to happen. And I'm like, I'm trying to be gentle. It was a horrible experience, which we both didn't enjoy. But, you know, it was, she's good now. And we're waiting for, we should probably have the Carmel lays on the 20th. High cons come shortly after. And we've got a bunch of other stuff. And I'm trying to get the Red Tigers off the ground, but they're fighting me.
Yeah.
Like, no, all right, we'll breed. No, all right, well, no. I'm like, I can pick one, Jesus. But
cool.
Cool.
Just one other thing I wanted to hit on that, you know, that they had over on the Facebook page, the Morelia Python pick of the week. And I'm sort of at a draw. I think Johnny Blaze definitely, like I said earlier in the week.
He was last week. We can't have him this week again.
No,
I know he's good.
he was this week because Tuesday was Will. Anyway.
Right. Anyway, like I know what I'm doing. God, don't listen to me.
Yeah, I know, right? Oh, geez.
Continue.
Julie, she goes by GFX. You know what
yes.
I'm talking about?
Yes.
She posted up her jungle flashpoint. Did you
yes.
see that one?
Very, very good looking jungle, yeah.
Yeah.
I also like some of the other pictures we're getting that are like, you know, just random. Like there's that green tree python picture.
With the mouth open?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a cool
look. Looked sinister and cool. And then, of course, you know, the rough scales, which are close to my heart.
Yeah, that was a nice one.
Yeah, one does. And then I threw some stuff up there this week just to be, because I got a whole bunch of pictures redone for Rogue, so I threw Echo up there a few times.
Yep, that's a cool snake, for sure.
I like
I guess the only other one that I liked was the, not the only other one I liked, but the one that caught my eye was the Striped Jungle that's from, I think it's Shipley's?
Yeah, even for a baby, that's a great-looking jungle.
And there was some kind of talk about whether it was from incubation or, you know, higher temperatures or, you know, that caused that stripe. But I don't know. I think, isn't it usually more, they're not as even, the striping when it's from incubation?
I don't know. I've not played with my incubation to try to get stripes, and I've gotten awesomely striped animals from just, like, breeding my...
Striped animals?
no, from... funny, shut up. From breeding my Leary Jag to my Hycon male, I got a bunch of striped animals. So I think it just kind of happens.
Okay.
So,
okay. Cool.
If I was breeding a tiger, and I got striped animals, and I was telling you about that, I wouldn't be, you know, all that surprised. But,
right.
You know.
I think if Mo made a super tiger, I think that's what it would look like. Yeah.
She should do that and then
yeah.
give it to me. Notice it gives, not tell.
Yeah.
So.
See how that goes.
You should be a girl to get a zebra. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. I guess we will we'll bring Sean on and,
yep.
you know, welcome to the show. Hey, Sean, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're doing good.
All right.
Congratulations, man, on your first clutch.
Thank you.
Like we were talking before, yeah, it's good to know that you're addicted after you've hatched your first clutch. If you weren't, then I'd be calling you up and buying some animals from you, man.
Yeah, I'd be over at his house right now. I'd be like,
that's
I
right.
want
I'd
that
be
one
for
and
house.
That one.
Oh, it's not as cool as I thought. I'd be like, great, I'll give you $100 for everything.
Everything, $100. The best deal you're going to find out there, buddy.
Yeah. You ain't going to get nothing for these mutts. What are you talking about?
Come on.
No, seriously, you know, you're addicted before, but once you first start seeing those babies come out of the eggs, it's at a whole nother level, man. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Especially you're a maternal, you're trying to maternally incubate at first, and when you are finally successful doing that, they start popping out of the eggs, you know, underneath mom. It's just, you can't help but whip your camera out and start taking pictures. It's just neat.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. So.
So it makes you feel a little bit better. You're like, I can breed them. Yes. So.
Yeah, I know.
Well, all right, Sean. Let's just jump right into it. And why don't you tell us how you got into reptiles and what brought you to carpet pythons?
Man, this is a really long story.
Do it.
I mean, I guess it's pretty long for everybody, and you know, we're all probably have similar stories. But I guess I'm from South Florida originally. Fort Lauderdale is actually where I was born. And my first house I remember living in, we lived on a canal, you know, and so we had water right behind the house and, you know, palmetto bushes and all that stuff out there. And I remember one day, you know, just doing my thing in the backyard and looking down deep into this palmetto bush, and there's this really cool orange, red, and black little snake curled up in there. And not knowing what it was, I thought it was a toy. And I grabbed it. Didn't bite me, thankfully. And I brought it in-house, showed my mom. And, of course, she got a little freaked out and was like, oh, my gosh, did it bite you? She had no idea what it was. But, you know, it was a little corn snake. And ever since then, man, I've really been into it. And a couple of years later, we moved to a little town outside of Boston, Massachusetts, believe it or not. And that was in 1978. And it was way out in the country. And I remember my first memory of that house was walking out in the backyard. And we had about an acre behind the house and seeing not one but two different types of snakes kind of cruising around back there. And even though we were on a street that was like 2 miles long and had four houses on it, I had no friends, but I had all kinds of critters to play with. So I was in seventh heaven, man. I was out there flipping logs and rocks. And, you know, I loved that house. And I still do. And, you know, I had a great time there. And then when I was about 12, we moved to Texas. And I got out of it for a couple of years because we moved into suburbia. And not much went on. But, you know, I met a guy who was probably 10 years older than me. And I'm sorry to say, I can't remember his name now because it's so long ago. This is 20 plus years ago now. He had a really big collection of reptiles, and I was 18 or 19 at the time and just graduated high school. And I talked him into going into business with me. And Bushmaster was in business back then, and we used to import tons of animals from them. And when I mean tons, we would buy ball pythons and lots of 300 for, you know, 10-15 bucks a piece. And, yeah, I mean, really cheap. And had I known then what I know now, I might be a ball python guy because I remember importing exantics and pastels and not knowing what they were and selling them to pet stores. And my partner kept all those animals in his house. And it wasn't just snakes. It was lizards. We used to import francil-tailed skinks and all kinds of cool stuff. And, you know, back then some of the new
stuff.
Yeah. It's one of those things you can't hardly ever find anymore. And we used to see all kinds of, you know, green basilisks and – it was a heck of a lot of fun, and I was the guy. I'd load them all up in the back of my probe in styro boxes and deli cups, and I'd drive to all these cities all over Texas, San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, and I would literally go knocking on doors of pet stores and say, hey, man, I got a bunch of really cool stuff. You want to check it out? And, you know, that's how that business started, and I did that for about a year. I was a Marine reservist at the time, and I got called up to go to that first Gulf War thing, and that kind of put an end to that whole deal. I was gone for a couple of years, and when I got back, all the animals had been pulled off. The guy that I was partners with was—he was more into taking care of them and not really into marketing. So he sold everything off and just kind of closed the business. And I went to college and got out of it for a couple of years, but then graduated school, went to Florida, went back to South Florida from Texas, I should say, because I have a lot of family there. Started my professional career there, and in 1995 or 96. I bought my first jungle carpet python, and I still have him today. I've posted him on the forum several times. His name's Speck. That's how I got hooked, man. That one snake that I still have, and he's never bred for me. He's either a homosexual snake or he's sterile, one or the other. But I know he's a male.
Come on.
But I know he's a male. I see sperm plugs on him all the time, but he's never bred for me. And you know what? That's cool. He still has a prominent place in my room, and you know, one of the biggest cages in there. And gosh, he's if I got him in 96, he's what, 18 years old, 17 years old, something like that now.
Wow.
Yeah, had him a long time. Yeah, and he's big. I mean, he's probably 7.5 feet long and big around as my forearm, and he's a big boy.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's all how right. I got started. Like I said, long story, man. I warned you.
It was good. It was good. It was cool. I hate to have a male that's just like, nah, no, I'm good. It's like, ah,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
All right. Now, can you tell us a little bit about MP Forums? What made you purchase the site? Because I think I was just starting off to being a member when there was talk about you buying the site and stuff like that.
Yeah, when we bought the site, I had been a member there for probably 5 years at that point. And Jim, who's a really good friend, who is actually the guy who founded the forums, just got completely out of the files, you know, like a lot of us do. He just, like, one day decided he didn't want to do it anymore, sold everything. And, you know, he told everybody, he said, look, I'm really busy, you know, and I've got a lot going on, and the site takes a lot of my time, and I'm going to shut it down unless somebody buys it. And, you know, I let that stew with a bunch of other people for a while because I don't know anything about owning or running a website. Computers aren't my thing.
Right.
Nobody stepped up, and I'm just, you know, I think I'm a little bit older than the average guy on the forum, and, you know, I was able to do it, and there's so much valuable information, you know, there's, you know, even more now, obviously, but back then there was, you know, we had just outed all the Jaguar Neuro stuff, and we're talking about it and theorizing about what causes it, and, you know, just kind of laying the groundwork that we've all had real hard to lay with, to working with this species, and that was all going to disappear, and I thought that was ridiculous. I didn't want to see that happen, so, you know, I made an offer, and Jim accepted it. I couldn't believe that he did, but he did. And, you know, we moved on from there, and I've learned a lot over the years. The first year was pretty rocky because I had no idea what I was doing, and I still really don't. In fact, I've found some people to help me with it a little bit. I mean, I really am. I'm one of the busiest guys that I know, and the last thing I needed to do was buy a website. But, man, I love this hobby so much, and to see that much information disappear would have been a real shame. I mean, it would have set us back, you know, a decade probably, and that just wasn't okay with me. So I bought it, and really, I try and keep it really low key. I don't, you know, get involved in a bunch of the big threads anymore. I really try and you know, I straightened out the site, and I made it really cheap for folks that you can go in and pay $5 and post a for sale ad on there now, and it used to be a lot more expensive than that, but it's really – for me, it's just about people coming and using the site and learning as much as they can about the species, because there's so many cool things to learn about carpet pythons that, you know, for it all to disappear would have been a real shame.
Yeah. Well, we're very glad you bought the site and you're holding it out for us. Definitely very good. Now, you have any future plans for the site in the works? Any changes you're going to start kind of poking around with?
Not really. You know, I have a lot of people that tell me, well, man, you need to get a website and post your animals and use the forums to sell your snakes. But, you know, that's not really what I'm about. I'm a hobbyist, man. My snakes are something I do because I enjoy doing it and it's fun. And, you know, could I do it as a business if I wanted to, really? But I don't. I want it to stay fun. And in order, you know, if I'm going to create a website and start using the forums to do all that stuff, I don't know. It's turning it more into a business, and that's just not what I want to do. So I've kept it really low key, and like I said, I just try and stay out of it and let the site take care of its own problems. And unless I really have to get involved, I don't do it. And I, you know, I post my animals for sale on the website like everybody else does. I don't even have a banner ad on my own website because I don't have a website. You know, it's true. As many animals as I have, I don't have a website where I sell my snakes. You know, I've got a really good network of, you know, guys like you and people who know me, and, you know, I'm blessed to have a lot of people in Texas who, you know, call me up when they're looking to talk about carpet pythons, because I've been here a long time and I've been doing them for a long time. So I don't really need a website. And, you know, one day when I'm retired, I may turn it into something more serious, but, you know, right now it's just for fun, and, you know, I'm having a blast doing it. And the only reason I've got the stuff that I have is because I've been doing it longer than a lot of other people. That's really it. I've been doing it a long time.
Right.
Nice. All right. And why don't you tell us about your collection? You know, what do you got going on down there? Some of your highlights.
It's probably easier to talk about what I don't have as far as carpet pythons. Well, you know, we're all kind of collectors, right? And the problem with carpet pythons is, you know, I've heard Nick say this once, and it's really true, is you kind of want the whole set. You know, you just want to work
with
one particular type, right? So, you know, you get the whole set of, you know, wild types, and then you get the whole set of mutations, and then you start crossing the mutations, and it starts getting more complicated from there. But no, the only thing I don't have right now, you know, that I really want are some of the dwarf species, and I know those aren't carpet pythons, but I'm really trying to get at least one good pair of everything Australian. And
I love my spotteds.
The only thing I really lack right now are the anthills. It's the only thing I don't have, and that are readily available. So I'd like to get some anthills. And, you know, I don't have any southwesterns either, but I'll get some of those eventually. There are enough of them around now, and I know everybody that's got them. I'll eventually get some. But, you know, I've got the albino gene already, and normal southwesterns look a lot like IJs to me. So I'll get some when they're cheap, and, you know, right now they're not. So I'll complete my set when I buy those. And then I keep hearing rumors that Owen Pelly's may be available someday. And if that's the case, you know, I'd spend a bloody fortune to get some of those. So.
Yeah, you and me both. Yeah.
So it's you and Eric with the Owen Pelly's. I'm like, I'll go over and see Eric's when he gets them. And then I'll make my decision then. But, you know, I mean, he's got this huge thing for the Owen Pelly's. I'm dying for some rough scales. I want them so bad.
I don't think
bad.
They're that cool. I've had so many people
want them
to me, and I think they're neat. Don't get me wrong, because, I mean, they're in the genus, and I love the whole genus, but it's like, you know, it's a chondro with brown keeled scales. Okay, I get it. You know, and they're super prolific, apparently, so I just think that, you know, I will end up with some eventually, but again, at the price point they're at right now, I'll wait it out. You know, I don't have any chondros either, so, you know, I've had some in the past, but I just, as many carpets as I've got now, I have to really draw my focus, but I'll end up with some eventually.
Yeah. I'm a glutton for punishment with my white lips, so why not jump into the rough scales? So
I guess then let's talk about maybe some projects that you have going on. Like what I know you have like cutting edge stuff. So as far as what do you have going on this year?
Well, I breed a lot later than most folks because it stays so warm for so long down here, and I really sort of rely on what's going on with the natural weather pattern here to kind of cue my snakes when to go. So I've still got pairs together right now, but it looks like I've got some pretty cool stuff coming. I mean, I've got a couple females that are looking grab, and I expect, hopefully, cross my fingers, knock on wood really loudly, to hit some zebra albino zebras this year.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, I really hope to hit some of those. I've got obviously more granite jags coming. I've got a gravid inland female. You know, and then a lot of the usual stuff. I'm going to produce some zebras. I know I should produce a super zebra this year. Gosh, what else is cooking back there? That's a pretty quick list. I mean, I've got a lot of the normal stuff. Some jags and jungle jags, and I'm trying to give John a run for his money. I should produce my first diamond jungles this year. They should be pretty nice. I've got Brian Hummel's line of jungle jags, which are really deep orange. They're really pretty, one of my favorite lines that I've seen in the country, and they're real high percentage jungle blood, and I put them back to an 88% diamond female, and she is gravid as all get out. So I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah, so
right.
I don't produce a bunch of clutches. I really don't, but I try for 10, and I usually hit 7 or 8 a year. So right. that's kind of my limit that I can care for because I run out of room for the babies.
Like with your this is just something that as a side note, with your granite jags, not that a lot of people have those, but I noticed that yours seem to stand out when I see pictures of them. Is that selective breeding that you've been working on for a while?
You know, I'd like to say that it is, but the granite mutation is a het trait. I mean, we all know that, and so it takes longer to work with it. And, you know, I'm still breeding my original pair that I got from overseas 7 or 8 years ago. So now this year I've actually got an adult male granite jag that I put back to a granite female. So that might produce something that's a little different looking, but no, they're like every other carpet python, man. They do seem to vary. I mean, I've got 4 now of various ages, and a couple of them are just smoking hot, and a couple of them are tipped out more than I'd like to see, but hey, it's still a granite jag. So,
what about your the 50/50 jungle project that you got going on? What's the story on those?
Well, it depends on which one you're talking about. I've got two animals that I've bred together.
Okay.
One is a male that I've posted on the site many times in the past, not so much in the last few years. He's got a real kind of a zippery pattern to him. He's probably 60% yellow, 40% black.
Yes.
And the black that's on him is just real. The only way I can describe it, like I said, is zippery, real angular type striping to him. It's kind of a cool look. And then I've got the female that I used to make Armorelia Python shirts, which is, she's got to be a 70-30. I mean, she's got 70% yellow on her, and she almost looks like a Carpondra because she's got greenish hue to her. And I've actually bred those animals together once, and they produced nothing but what appeared to be very normal-looking jungle babies. So, you know, I got to dinking around with both of those, and what I mean by that is I took that male and I said, okay, why would this crazy male produce normal-looking jungles but not, you know,
right,
anything unusual? So I started putting them with a bunch of other stuff, and you know, I had some really big hybrid, just mud ugly females, and I crossed a couple of those big females, and what I discovered was that that appearance appears to be almost a codon, behaving like a codon, or you know, a dominant actually mutation. Half the babies would be ugly mutts, and the other half would look just like their dad.
Huh.
So now I'm thinking it may be something cool. So I've actually kept back all the babies from the last couple of years, and next year should be the first year that my females are going to be big enough to put back the dad, and I'm going to breed those and see what happens. And the big female that I have, the 70-30 female, I've used her the last 2 years to make zebras with, and those zebras have come out amazing. I was really lucky in picking up a super nice male from Paul. He let me pick my own, hand-pick a male, and I got lucky and just picked a good one. And
nice.
That male sired 3 clutches the first year and 2 clutches last year. And
nice.
The mom, that 70-30 female was a mother both years, and the jungles were just amazing. Or the zebras and the jungles were amazing from that clutch. But I don't think that's a hereditary trait from her, but I do think the father's got something going on. So I'm trying to work with that and see what it is. Because if there's a super form, I'd love to see what it is.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
What about your striped jungles?
You know, I get a lot of people asking about that. I've still got all of them. That clutch was like 12 babies, I think, 8 of which had either 2/3 or their entire body with that black stripe down the top. And then the other 4 or so were normal. They're all really, you know, good colors, but they come from, you know, from nice parents, so that shouldn't surprise anybody. But I really don't think, because I've bred those parents together again and gotten just normal babies, I really think that's a temperature incubation thing. So I don't know for sure, but I really think that's what it is. And I've always said that, and I don't really talk a bunch with a lot of the other guys, but, you know, Nick's probably my best friend in herpeticulture, and, you know, we talk once a week or so. And, you know, that's, we both theorize, and I'm going to breed them. The females are going to be big enough to go next year, and I'll see what happens, but... Man, I'd love for it to be some kind of a mutation, but I honestly don't think it is. I think it's a mutation. So.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
what about the another one that you have is the red hypo jag? What are your thoughts on that, and do you think that that's something that's related to the caramel? Do you think that they're related?
Well, yeah, first of all, you know, I want to tell everybody that might be listening that you know, don't take the hypo like you would with ball pythons or some other stuff as being a, you know, a directly inheritable gene. What I'm referring to as hypo when I call something a red hypo is not, I'm not trying to market the animal, I'm just trying to describe it. Red hypos are clearly different. And over the last couple of years, some of the guys have a little more experience, like you guys and some of the other folks from the forums. You know what you're looking at when you see a red hypo. You
right.
Know what it is. And there's, you know, the only way to call it, you know, as there is a reduced amount of black. I mean, the under pattern is really clean, really creamy, or really white, you know, and that to me is a hypo. Is it, you know, directly inheritable? I don't think so, you know, not the hypo part of it anyway. But I've been working with those, you know, I bought a female really read Normal Coastal from Will Leary. That was direct descendant of Madame Blueberry 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago. And I paid $1,000 for that girl because she was so cool looking. I mean, he said, here, $1,000. And I said, here, take it. You know, that's how bad I wanted it.
Nice.
Yeah. And she's been the founding, you know, female. And then I also picked up, you know, hit the nicest Jag male that he produced that year as well. I bought it at the same show. And those two produced the coolest looking red hypos that I've ever seen. In fact, Nick, if you're listening, that female's looking grab it, buddy. She's I sent him a red hypo female years ago when he was anti-Jag. I sent him the best one I had and said, tell me that you don't love Jags after you take a look at that animal. And, man, she's smoking hot.
Yeah.
But he didn't have anything to put her with, so he actually sent her to me last year, and I couldn't get her to go last year. I put her with her dad this year, and it looks like she's going to go this year. So we may have some answers regarding, you know, what kind of a trait we're actually dealing with here. Do I think it's the same thing as a caramel? I don't know. I wrote a little bit about that on the forums the other day, just in kind of an answer to somebody's question on the forums. And I don't have enough caramels to be definitive on that. The caramels that I do have are all very young. And, you know, I've honestly never seen a caramel, you know, as an adult in person. I've never seen one. I've seen lots of pictures, but I've never seen one in person. You know, but I've got red Jags, red hypo Jags, and red normals coming out of my ears now. It's the only form of coastal that I work with now. I've gotten rid of all my normal stuff, and because the reds are just so hot. And you know, I don't know if it's the same gene or a similar gene, because you know, there's different pastels in the ball python market. They're all the same thing. You know, there's a butter and what's the other.
Lesser,
Yeah, there's a butter and a lesser, but they're pretty much the same thing. They may be a different tweak on the same gene, but they're pretty much the same thing. You know, I think that might be the same thing, or maybe just a different, you know, tweak on that gene. You know, or it just could be a red form of a coastal, a regular coastal carpet that throws red babies. I mean, that's not unheard of either, but it does seem to be a dominantly inherited mutation. When I breed them, I get normals, clearly normals, and I get reds. And the reds vary from not so great to mind-blowingly cool. And then you throw the Jag on top of it, and you get the same thing. You get, you know, not so great red Jags, really cool red Jags, and a couple that are just freaking awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's exactly what you get when you mess with the caramels. So, but I just don't have enough of them to say if I think they're the same. Nick swears that they're not, and he's seen both. He had that female of mine for years before he sent it back to me. Actually, it's his female. I say it's mine because I bred it, but it's his. I gave it to him. When he sent it back to me, I'm looking at these little Jag, caramel Jag females that I've got, and they don't look all that different from my red Jag babies from last year. They're pretty similar, I think. So I just don't know, and I think if anybody crosses the two together, it's just going to mess it all up. You may get some wicked cool-looking snakes, but it's going to be really hard to tell after that, you know.
What's going on. Right.
So I'm really going to try and keep them separate, at least until we know for sure what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. There are other people among us who breed red tigers to caramel Jags and other things.
Yeah, but the red tiger that I think that's different, though. You know, like the red tiger that Jason has is not from the Madame Blueberry line, so it doesn't throw the same type of caramel-esque.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Careful, though, his red tigers just sure are. So.
My reds originally came from hers, but then I picked up a big female that I had for about 3 years. I called her my Madame Blueberry clone. Because she looked just like Madame Blueberry. She was a really big female that looked just like Madame Blueberry. I sent some pictures to Nick years ago, and you know, he agreed with me that whatever it was the exact same type of animal, either from the same clutch or from the same locality, if there is such a thing. And you know, she threw exactly the same types of babies when I bred her to Warchild, my male. So, it's the only coastal type that I work with now. Just because they're so great. They're just so cool looking. And they keep that creamy yellow under pattern color and that orangey brick red saddle color all the way into adulthood. I mean, the female that I've back there now is 5 years old and she still looks fantastic. You know, she looks great. She's got to be 2,400 grams, somewhere around there. She's a big girl.
I have a caramel Jag, and I have a red hypo-type Jag, and that came from Luke Snell, and that's the line, the Madame Blueberry line that he's working with. And hands down, the red hypo Jag, way better.
Yeah.
1,000 times better.
my opinion right now, because of the animals that I've got, the caramels that I have, is I like the red hypos too. But I've got 30 red hypos. Or red coastals, and I've got 3 caramels. So I'm only saying that because I've got a bigger sample group of one side. And I've seen some of the pictures that the other guys have posted of the caramel stuff, and there are some exceptional caramels out there too. So again, I just don't have as much experience with that gene. But, you know, I should produce a fair number here in the next couple of years, and I should have a more definitive answer.
Cool.
That and the reds have been line bred. So what Eric is getting out of red Jags has been you know, phenomenal animal across with phenomenal animal. I mean, eventually the caramels could hit to that point where you start line breeding things, you're going to get something that looks entirely different than what you started, like for the better.
Yeah, and I don't know how long they've been line bred. The original, my first introduction to caramels was back when I bought that red female and that really nice red male 7 or 8 years ago from Will. And there was a guy there, I can't remember his name now, from France. He came with just a photo album, bought a table at the NARBC show like we did, but all he had was a photo album at his table with all these cool carpets that he had. And his name was Nico, I think, but I can't really remember. I think that was it. And he had caramels in his book, and he was describing them as caramels, and I thought, wow, those look a lot like red coastals. They're a little different. They're a little more of an orange color, but they look really similar. But I didn't really think that much of them. And then here we are, you know, almost a decade later, and, you know, it's a – dominant mutation, and everybody wants one, and they've been around for a while. How much they've been line bred, I don't know, but I do know that it's been around at least as long as people have been working with the red hypos. At least not at least in Europe. It hasn't been here, but I know it's been in Europe for a while.
Right.
So.
Interesting. So, Sean, how do you? Why don't you give us a rundown of how you keep your carpets? You know, what temps do you keep them at, and what kind of caging do you use?
Man, I'm really low tech. You know, the cool thing, one of my favorite things about carpet pythons is they're tough as nails. It's hard to make them sick, man. I really, as many as I have, I very rarely get RIs with my animals. And I think that's for a couple reasons. It's pretty dry here a lot of times of the year, which I think, you know, helps a little bit with that. But, I really, my snake room in the wintertime gets pretty cold. My snake room, just so everybody knows, is, you know, I've posted pictures of it before. It's nothing fancy. I've got a 3-car garage. I walled off one car garage worth of it on the far side of the garage, and it's just one big long tube of a room with cages floor to ceiling along all the walls. I've insulated the garage door. It's still open, so on spring days and stuff, there's no window. There's no natural light in the room. I don't mess with light cycles at all. I just don't. When I wake up in the morning and go to work, I turn the light on, and at night before I go to bed, I turn the light off. And, you know, as far as temps go, you know, the ambient temperature, because it's a garage, is I've got two walls, the garage door and then one wall, that are, you know, outside walls all the time. So in the wintertime, when it's freezing cold out, I've got one space heater in there that sort of keeps the room warm. And, you know, I've got heat tape under every cage, obviously, but. And in the summertime, it gets really hot. So in the winter, you know, when I'm cooling, my room will get down to, you know, in the 60s sometimes. It'll warm up a little during the day, but at night it'll get pretty cold. And in the summertime, it can get up into the high 80s, sometimes low 90s, because it gets brutally hot here in Dallas. In the summertime, 105, 106 degree temperatures are pretty common for 6 or 8 week stretches. So my snake room gets really hot. And, you know, I turn all the heat off, and, you know, I open the garage door at night and let the room vent out, because it just gets so hot in there. And I've got an air conditioning unit in there, but it just can't keep up because it's so hot. But that's, you know, I think with those temperature extremes, you know, you would think that I'd have sick animals all the time, but it's really the opposite. As many as I have, I really don't get RIs a lot because I don't have cold, moist, humid winters. They're usually, you know, I get cold, but they're really dry. And in the summertime, kind of the same thing. We get really high temperatures, but it's really dry. So they just don't get a lot of that goo up in there in the lungs, in the respiratory systems, you know what I mean? And they seem to do really well. I'm not saying I don't get them. I do get animals with RIs, you know, I get one or two a year, but I've got like 250 snakes back there. So, you know, it happens.
Right.
But I'm really low tech. I don't have a, you know, my heater runs basically at the same temperature setting day and night, you know, and when I do adjust temperature for cooling periods, I adjust that heater down and leave it alone. I don't raise the temperature up during the day and at night. But what I do is I've got Helix systems running all my heat tape, and those are set for day and night temperatures. So especially in cooling season, I let my snakes get really cold. And I do it for extended periods of time, 3, sometimes 4 weeks. But I have to wait for the winter here to get cold, again, because of those two exterior walls being on the outside of the house. And that doesn't happen here until January usually. So I cool really late in the season, and I let them get pretty cold. And then I simulate spring, warm the room up, warm the heat tape up, start spraying all the cages, you know, to simulate a spring rain. And, man, I get lockups right away. And we do really well, but very low tech, guys. I mean, my heat tape is all hand wired, and you know, I literally have a Home Depot space heater that's plugged in and heats the entire room. And there's only one, you know, because I don't want two in case one malfunctions, because then you've got two in there running, and I don't want that to happen.
Cook anybody, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd rather a room get cold than hot, because heat kill a snake way faster than cold will. So
yes.
I'm there every day.
Yeah.
So. But, yeah, man, really low tech. I mean, to the point that it drives some people crazy. I mean, my very first Granite Jag clutch, everybody was really excited about, and I maternally incubated it. I let the mom do all the work. I didn't jack with her or the cage, and I just let her do her thing, and she did a fantastic job. That was one of my most successful Granite Jag clutches ever. It was the very first one, and I let the mom do everything. So she was a great mom. But that's one of the things about the species is, you know, you let them, you know, take their cues from nature and do the rest, and they generally do a pretty good job. So, and I love minimalist setups. I clean the cages regularly enough to keep them from being disgusting, but, you know, I don't rush in there every time I see snake poop. I think sometimes, you know, I'm serious. I think sometimes, you know, people, if you keep a cage too clean, if it's sterile all the time, you know, and don't be surprised when your animal gets an RI. It has no immune system. It never happens
right.
By anything off because you keep its cage like a hospital room all the time. And I'm not saying you should keep, you know, an inch of snake crap in your cage all the time. But what I am saying is, you know, they're relatively tough animals. And if you look at pictures of them, you know, captured in the wild, they're these long, skinny, you know, thin snakes. And, you know, we feed them an awful lot in captivity, and they don't get enough exercise. And we keep them in these super clean cages. And then, you know, you do get some kind of a bug in your snake room, and, you know, everybody gets freaked out when the whole collection, you know, gets the sniffles, and that's because they have no immune systems. Every once in a while, you got to let their bodies, you know, don't feed them for 3 weeks every once in a while. Let them thin out a little bit. That's okay. I mean, don't do it when you're prepping them for breeding season, obviously.
Yeah.
You know?
Do it when it's right. Do it at the right time, but yeah.
Right. But, you know, you got to remember that these animals are, you know, they're not really designed to be kept in a box, and when you're stuffing them full of food all the time and you're keeping them in a super sterile environment all the time, I think they're more likely to get sick when they do get a bug. You got to let their bodies, you know, do the work. You got to let them process some body fat. You got to let them fight off a little bug here and there so that they're healthier animals, you know?
Right.
Right.
So, now for feeding wise, do you keep your animals on the smaller side with feeding, or do you kind of just, I mean, compared my snakes with Eric's, his red tigers are the perfect example. His are relatively. How big is your biggest red tiger, Eric?
Maybe, I don't know, 2,500 grams tops.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
And
nowhere near the size of yours.
Yeah, like, you know, his is like a 4-footer, mine's like a 7 or 8 footer. And they're both from the same clutch, just, you know, different day takes. Sean, do you keep yours kind of smaller, or do you kind of just let them get big?
First of all, I feed all frozen thawed.
Yeah,
me too. I feed my stuff differently depending on what it is. And what I mean
okay.
by that is there are animals that clearly I'm going to keep for breeder stock when I get them. And
so I want
them to grow a little quicker. And then there are the animals that I know I'm going to sell, and I'm not in a big hurry to get them huge because then I got to find a place to put them. And I'd like to keep them in shoeboxes. I'd like to keep them in shoeboxes.
Shoeboxes, yeah.
Exactly. So those animals, I'll feed, you know, smaller prey items, but I still feed at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
what I found with, you know, with my carpets, especially when they get around 2 years old, is, you know, they seem like they're growing really slow. And you get them to about 18 months to 2 years, and you start feeding them less often, but you give them a bigger meal.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they start packing on weight. You know, and I've talked to a couple people about this, and you know, my personal feelings, and again, it's all theory, right? What we're all doing here, but you know, I think sometimes when you make an animal work to eat that prey item, and what I'm, you know, just stretch out a little bit, you know, have to spread the jaws a little wider than normal. You know, I'd rather feed a medium rat than two rat pups. You know what I mean? And nutritionally, maybe they're pretty close, and I think the snake's body adapts to the prey that it's being fed. Okay, so, you know, bear with me, but if an animal's in the wild and the food that's available for them to eat is something that's a little bit difficult for them to swallow, the body's probably going to be cued to grow a little quicker, at least in my opinion, so that it can more readily accept the prey that's available, okay? Whereas if it's eating a bunch of prey that's really easy for it to swallow and it's got to eat three or four at a time to get the same nutritional value, maybe the body's not getting the cues to grow as big. You know, just because you're getting the calories doesn't mean that it's equating to growth. You know, it can equate to fat, it can equate to, you know, excess poo. You know, it's just
right.
But there's something around that 18 month to 2.5 year window that if you start feeding them larger prey items than you think, you know, they would normally eat, they put on massive weight. I mean, that's my time for my females to put on weight is 2.5 to 3.5 year when that 1 year they'll triple their weight in that 1 year. Because
that's
I never really push girls. I always try and breed them at 3.5 years. And that 2.5, 3.5 year mark is when I really start going, okay, instead of giving you two small rats, I'm going to give you a large rat. And then I'm not going to feed you for 2 weeks until I can't see that rat in your belly anymore. You know, and I really do. I think that cues the body to go, hey, you know what? There's bigger prey item available now. I need to grow. I need to get a bigger body so that I can consume this stuff more easily. And it seems to work. And everybody that I've spoken to and kind of explained that theory agrees with me on that. I don't think it's caloric intake. I think it's the size of the prey that's available that cues them to grow.
That's interesting.
That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So, Sean, can you give us a rundown of what you do for what your approach is to breeding with temps? What do you do when you do it? And of course, are you a maternal incubation guy or are you artificial?
I've done both. And like we talked a little bit about earlier, I'm pretty minimalist. And the way my room is set up, I've got to wait for nature to cue. And I've always been that way. When the weather cools outside is when I cool my snake room. When I know that, okay, cold fronts are moved in, winter's finally here, then I'll start dropping the temps. Because what I don't want to happen, and this happens here in Texas every few years, is you have a spell for a week where it's really cold, and then the temps go up to 80 freaking degrees. You know, and it just, you're like, you know, you kind of feel like you're messing up. And those are the years that I have a harder time breeding my animals because it's just not a consistent cooling period. And I know some guys don't cool at all, but I really think that it helps. I think when I simulate a winter and I bring the temps way, way down, you know, I keep a hot spot in the cages of about 75 to 80 degrees all the time, you know, with the heat tape. But I'll let my room get down to 60 degrees, you know, and there have been times when it's gotten below that when it gets really cold and the heater can't keep up, you know, in the wee hours of the morning. But they seem to do fine. They sit on the heat tape, you know, they curl up. They don't move around much. They don't obviously feed that time of the year, so I'm not worried about any of that stuff. I keep fresh water in there, but I mostly just leave them alone and make sure the heat tape's running. And they do fine. And then I cool them, like I said, for 3 to 4 weeks, somewhere in there, not very long. And then I simulate spring by just ratcheting up the temps, you know, a few degrees a day. I do that for about a week and a half or 2 weeks. And towards the end of that second week, I start spraying the cages a bunch to simulate rains. And, man, I start throwing girls in with females, and it's on. And, you know, I can get one male to go with three females fairly regularly. If that male is small and ornery, it's relatively easy to do. The bigger males, it's harder to get to do that. But
yeah,
females, it's not too bad. My jungle male that I got from Paul years ago is just a monster. And, you know, he's got to be, what, 4.5 years old, something like that. And he's still maybe 800 grams. He's not that big. I don't want him big because he breeds better when he's small. So,
right.
And it works well. Now, also one of the things that I do is a little controversial, and you know, maybe it's because I'm super lazy, I don't know, but again, the snakes for me, I do like them internally and incubate them, but it depends on the individual snake. You know, if she loads a clutch of eggs, they're not sticking together and they're rolling all over the floor of the cage, I'm going to pull up the eggs, put them in the box, and, you know, I've got an incubator, and, you know, when I've got two or three clutches that I want to put in the incubator, I'll use my little incubator. When I've got five or six, because I've just got five or six moms not doing the job, actually, I have a bathroom at my office that I use as an incubator. I have a heater in that room, and it heats the whole bathroom up, and, you know, I have a humidifier running there all the time, and I put them in a vermiculite and mix and in a tub and check on them every day and make sure there's air moving in and out of the tub, and they do fine. They just can't let them get too wet, but I really like maternal incubation because I just think it's cool. I mean, the whole reason I'm into the animals is their behavior. And to get to watch them raise their own babies is just awesome.
Yeah, it's so cool.
It is.
I'll work on that.
Have you ever taken a fresh shed off a snake and it feels wet and oily, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've all done that. You know, I think there's something going on when a carpet python wraps so tightly around a clutch that there's just not a lot of air going in and out of there. And, you know, they've got their nose ducked down into those coils, and they're exhaling some moisture onto the eggs. And I don't know. Sometimes I think maybe there are a little bit of that oil's coming through the skin and keeping those eggs nice and soft and moist. You know what I mean? They just seem to do better. I have a harder time in an incubator with eggs than I do just leaving them with the mom. If she's a good mom. If she's a bad mom, the eggs will all go bad. You just got to take them out. But if they coil them nice and tight, cover them where you can't even see them, and, you know, I've had them move them around the cage to optimal temperature spots before, you know, let them do their thing. And they seem to do great. And that's, you know, the best part about it is, you know, 2 months later, all the little baby heads start popping out between the coils, and that's just cool. That's just so cool.
Yeah, that's a great job.
That is awesome.
You just get excited. Well, my kids love that time of year, too. I mean, they'll go out with me every day, and they're like, let's check, you know, and we start looking in all the cages to see where the babies are popping out. So,
I wonder why carpet pythons seem to be the python that is most, you know, like, that seems to be, they're the best at that. I mean, I know all pythons are incubating the eggs, but why does it seem like nobody else in any other python species genre try that? Have you seen that?
I would say, A, they're a longer-bodied snake, so I think they've got more body to do that with, but I don't think all carpets do that, and again, this has just been my experience. My bread lie, and I've been breeding brettles for a long time, are the worst moms ever. They're terrible. Well, for two reasons. One, they have enormous clutches, so they have a hard time wrapping the clutch anyway. But even when they have a smaller clutch, man, they just knock the eggs all over the cage and just don't take care of them. They've just been really bad. But my iCave and my jungles are fantastic at it. My coastals are like 50-50, but my iCaves and my jungles have been great at it.
Yeah.
And my brettles have just been terrible. So, and, you know, I'm going to see if the inlands will do it this year, but I don't know if they will or not, but we'll see. But part of my minimalist setup, you know, and you know, I'm sort of outing myself a little bit here, but I'm not a nest box guy. I don't provide nest box. I'm a newspaper cage guy, and when they're ready to breed or when they're ready to drop the eggs, here's how I know. They get all up underneath the newspaper, and they coil up nice and tight, and that's what tells me when they're ready to go. They don't hide under the paper when they're not gravid. When they're gravid, they get up under the paper, and that's a clear sign that they're going to drop eggs soon. So they seem to do fine. They find a place in the cage that works well for them, and they drop their clutch whether there's a nest box or not.
It kind of doesn't matter. Now, Sean, have you kind of gotten any merit to? I've heard that jaguars make very bad mothers, and they're not very good at coiling clutches and things like that. Is there any merit to that? Have you seen that?
I only have one adult jag female that I've bred more than once, and she is not a maternally incubated female.
Neither is mine. She's an idiot.
She's not good. But again, I think that because she's so big, more like the brettles, I think her problem is, you know, she has 25 or 26 eggs, you know, in a clutch. That's a lot of eggs to wrap around and hold. So I think that has something to do with it. The smaller species seem to do it better because they have a smaller clutch.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, I have I usually have about 30 eggs for like per clutch when it comes to my girls, and none of them will be able to wrap it up. So,
yeah.
And there's my one big girl who kind of just spreads all 50 of hers around the room, so it's, I definitely understand where you're coming from with that. Now, Sean, how do you feel about culling certain animals?
This is a trick question. You guys are you guys are the media now. You're setting me up.
I read what Eric says.
I've got some pretty controversial views on that, but it's a lot of that comes from, you know, who I am and where I live. I mean, I'm from Texas, mm-hmm. and I come from farmer, rancher type people, and you know, I've been around animals all my life, and in along with keeping those animals, there's some culling involved, and you know, this is a we work with carpet pythons, and the thing about carpet pythons, more than of the other species, is there are guys like me who are just rampant hybridizers. I want to create granite jacks, which means I have to cross the coastal with an IJ. You know, and that leaves me with some animals that, you know, aren't going to be super desirable. And figure out what to do with those animals. And if I can find a channel to sell them through, then I'll find a channel to sell them through. But I think, you know, for me as a breeder, it's irresponsible for me to take those animals and then sell them into the marketplace for $30 a piece. Which I could easily do. I could find a guy who doesn't care and sell them for $30 a piece. But I really think that does harm to the guys like Nick and those guys who are just, you know, carpet pythons, we can't just get them from the wild. You know, we can just, like ball pythons, import 5,000 of them when, you know, we're short on wild blood. So I think it really doesn't do the hobby a lot of good when you take a bunch of animals that are hybrids and you throw them out there. And you know, I can represent them correctly for what they are, but what ultimately is going to happen is they're going to be misrepresented by somebody, either when they're sold or, you know, somebody's going to own them and just call it a Tyrian Jaya because that's what they think it is, and even though it's, you know, neither. It's a cross between a jungle and a coastal, you know. And, you know, for a guy like me, if I've got a purpose for the animal, I can sell it, or if I can, you know, assure that it's going to go someplace that it's not going to harm the guys who are trying to keep, you know, their purest lines pure and keep, you know, the subspecies as clean as possible out in the hobby. If I can't protect those guys, then, you know, what good am I doing the hobby at all? So I really, sometimes I will, man, I'll flat cull the animals, and it doesn't mean I throw them in a freezer. You know, I keep blackheads. And you know, blackheads like to eat snakes, and actually they're healthier for it. And when I've got some that I don't think are going to do the market a whole lot of good, I'll use them as feeding. That's a really controversial stance that, you know, I've started some threads on multiple forums, and I get the crap kicked out of me whenever I do that. But, you know, I'm doing it from a place where, you know, we're not dealing with ball pythons here. And when you are making hybrids, which I make, and, you know, a lot of the guys who are purists got to admit that the stuff that, you know, the guys like Eric and I are crossing together, we make some wicked carpets. But the flip side of that is some normal animals that aren't quite jungles, they're not quite coastal, they're not quite Arian Jays, they're pet quality carpet pythons. And to flood the marketplace with those, that doesn't mean I won't sell them to an individual as a pet. But what I'm talking about is I'm not going to wholesale 30 of them to a guy who's, you know, then going to call them something that they're not and sell them for $100 a piece. You know, or worse, send them to a pet store where nobody really cares what they are and they just call them random carpet pythons, and then someone someday looks at it that doesn't have as much experience as maybe you or I do, and they go, oh yeah, that's an IJ, no problem, and they label it as an IJ, and now it's an Arian Jaya carpet python. Well, it's not, and you know, we're hurting the purest guys when we do that. So I try and be responsible by culling my animals, and you know, that's actually earned me some enemies, and that I'm okay with that. I mean, that's part of what we do. I mean, I love the animals that I work with, but I also love the hobby, and I appreciate the other guys who are trying to do what they can do. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of selling super cheap snakes that are end up in 10-gallon aquarium in somebody's house that's not gonna take care of them anyway. That's not the business I want to be in. So, but yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, I think I explain it really well to people sometimes, and I'm cold-blooded killer, but at the same time, I think as a responsible person, if I'm going to be the guy who hybridizes carpet pythons, I need to be the guy that's willing to pull the trigger on maybe calling some of the animals that are going to do the marketplace harm down the road. And if you're not willing to do that, I think then you should, you know, evaluate what you're doing. Because because I think the purists have a point, right? I mean, they can't just go get more pure jungle carpet pythons. They just can't. And the more that hybridize stuff, the more we jeopardize their hobby and their ability to enjoy their hobby. So, you know, I think to respect them, and this is one of the reasons why Nick and I are such good friends, right? Is, you know, he's a rampant purist, and I'm a crazy rampant hybridizer. But we're best friends. And, you know, the reason for that is I really respect his opinion. And I actually, you know, practice some culling, you know, practices, you know, in my collection that sort of keep my animals from messing up what he's doing, you know.
Right.
And as brutal as that is, and again, I'm not stepping on their heads. I'm not throwing them in freezers and slowly feeding them to death. You know, I'm using them as feeder animals. Just we have rats and mice to our snakes. And, you know, everybody's okay with that, but you feed a snake to another snake and everybody gets really upset. So, you know, and, you know, that's how I approach it. I mean, I if one can be used as food for another, that's what I'm going to do. And if that helps the purists out there and that keeps the market a little bit cleaner, then I'm all for that. So, but again, a lot of people don't agree with that, but, you know, a lot of people have three or four pet snakes. They all have names. You know, I've got 250 and only two or three of them have names. And it's more than just a bunch of pets for me. It's not a business quite, but it is a hobby. And, you know, within that hobby, I've got some snakes, and I would probably consider them pets. But most of them are animals, and I got to figure out what I'm going to do with them. I'm either going to sell them or I'm going to, you know, or I'm going to cull them. And am I saying I cull a ton of animals every year? No, I don't. But I probably do cull 25 or 30 a year from some of my hybrid clutches because I just don't want them going out into the world, you know, and ultimately being misrepresented is something that they're not. I just don't think that's fair to the other guys in the hobby. So, anyway.
Right.
You
know, that's funny that you used the blackhead, because I have a blackhead in my collection, and my idea was exactly the same thing. Is, you know, I'm going to have that, and, you know, blackheads eat snakes, so...
Yeah,
there you
messed up my curious market, Eric. I know where to find you. So,
right. Well, and you know, I'm really glad you say that, Eric, because it's one of those things that, I mean, you throw that out on a ball python forum and they all freak out on you, but it's because they're
yeah.
They're not dealing with the same thing and that you know some of the larger scale breeders are. And at the end of the day, when we pick, you know, basically an intergrade or a hybrid between, you know, two of these subspecies, we are doing the hobby some damage if we just flood the market. And, you know, I can make probably $3,000 or $4,000 a year selling all these babies if I wanted to, but it's
right.
not about the money. It's not about the money for me. It's about furthering the species and the hobby. And
yep.
I just don't think a responsible guy who's going to take the risk of hybridizing is doing the right thing by taking all those mongrel snakes and sending them out to the world that really doesn't have the eye to be able to identify truly what they are, and they're going to end up misrepresenting them. And it's not even probably their fault. They probably think they know what it is, but they really don't.
Right.
And, you know, that's bad. And, you know, does it give carpet guys a bad rap? I don't know. Maybe. You know, another one of my good friends in the hobby really doesn't like me to talk about culling because he's like, man, you just, you know, I know a lot of people that do that, but really I wish you wouldn't talk about it because it makes us sound bad. But I disagree. I think we're being responsible, you know, with the animals that, you know, that we breed. I mean, for the longest time, boxers, you know, I don't know if you know this, but boxers can have pure white, you know, boxer babies. In fact, I have one.
Right.
But they've got problems with deafness. And so
yeah.
you know, breeders for the longest time would cull them because it's a genetic defect and they didn't want to, you know, continue that. And a lot of them, you know, just through pressure stopped doing that. But that's not really, you know, an unfair practice. I mean, you don't want to take a snake that feeds really badly and breed it and all the babies feed like crap and then, you know, grow those up and breed those because you're going to continue a line of snakes that just are horrible feeders. You should probably cull that animal and work with an animal that feeds better and is healthier and is going to do better in captivity. And that's really what we're talking about. It's just what's best for the animals, what's best for the hobby. And if you're using them responsibly, I think, as a feeder, I don't see the ethical problem with it. But, again, that's, you know, that's one of
yeah.
those up in the air sort of things. So.
Yeah. We have a caller over here that I'm going to click on, if you guys don't mind, to see what
go for it.
Hello, he goes by NightFang65. Hello?
They also want to make money in the process of your death.
Hello?
What?
I don't...
Problem on planet.
I don't know what that was. All right.
What the hell is that? Anyway,
all right, fair enough.
Sean, real quick, would you also consider culling birth defects? I think I usually get I had one last year. 2 years ago, I had a two-headed snake that ended up just dying on me. And then that same year, I had one with a little bit of an overbite. Just kind of had a little bit of an overbite. Would you consider calling some kind of like a birth defects like that?
You know, it depends. Again, you know, if you have your very first clutch of carpets, you know,
yeah.
Eric, you know, it's really hard to make those kind of decisions. And because you really are digging the whole thing, and this is your first clutch. And so imagine you've got two carpet pythons, and you had a clutch of babies, and you've got this one that's got an overbite. Are you going to want to cull that? Probably not. You're going to work really hard. You're going to work really hard to find that animal a home. And
right.
I get that.
Somebody
I get that.
Do anything yet.
And you probably will be able to find an animal a home because you've got a dozen babies or whatever that you've got to get rid of. But a guy like me, who again, this is really a hobby for me still. It's not a business, but I produce 150 babies a year, you know, 200 babies a year sometimes. That's a lot. And, you know, if I get an animal that's got a birth defect or isn't a really good feeder, I don't see the point in, A, I can't keep it from my breeding stock because I can't use it. I don't see the point in adding it into a, you know, a wholesale group, you know, because I do wholesale, you know, pure jungles and pure stuff. I can't see adding it to a wholesale group of animals because are they going to be able to find a home for it? I don't know. Maybe. I just think it's more fair to the animals when they're babies, when they're little like that, you know, to make that decision. But again, for me, I've got so many, it's easier for me to make that decision. For somebody who's, you know, I've probably had hundreds of carpet python clutches now over the last decade and a half.
Right.
You know, but if this were my first two or three or maybe my first couple of years, I don't know that I'd feel the same way. You know, I think that's part of it. I mean, maybe am I callous or have I gotten kind of cold-hearted? Maybe, but I've seen the results of, you know, inbreeding, you know, animals that have got issues. I mean, albino boas, what, had issues with, you know, missing eyes and blindness for years and years and years until people outcrossed them enough and started calling the animals that they just couldn't breed. And, you know, I think that that should be happening with any type of animal. I mean, people do it with cows, they do it with goat, they do it with dogs, they do it with cats. I mean, it's part of being in, you know, in livestock business, which is what we all are. It's a hobby, but at the end of the day, you produce all these babies. If you're not going to keep them all, you got to sell them. So it is a little bit of a business, and you have to approach it like that. And the responsible thing, in my opinion, to do is to very quickly and as soon as they come out of the egg, if you identify there's a problem, is to call the animal.
Right.
You know, I do. In fact, interesting aside here, I actually feed my slugs to my blackheads too.
Really?
Blackheads will eat slug eggs all day long.
Wow.
They really will eat anything. So
now, just on a side note, have you tried breeding blackheads at all?
I was gonna try this year. Here's the downside of feeding snakes to your blackheads all the time.
Uh-huh.
I'm terrified to put the two of them in together.
Yeah, I didn't think of that.
Well, you know, I'm terrified every year when I put my cow kings together.
My blackheads are hetaxanthics, so I really wanted to try and put them together, but I think they're still a little small this year, so I'm going to wait one more year, and that decision is made a lot easier by knowing that I'm not going to have to hover over their cage every 10 minutes and make sure they're not.
Don't eat each other. Please,
right.
Don't eat each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and you know, in the wild, they eat a bunch of snakes, right? So, and one of the big complaints on blackheads, and you know, I've listened to Derek's show before, as you know, you want to try and vary their diet as much as you can, because if you stick them with rats all the time, they have a tendency to get pretty fat. And you know, I believe that, so I feed them as many reptiles as you know as humanly possible when I can, and I'm just terrified that they're going to end up eating each other. And there is a little bit of size difference between the two of them too, and I'm trying to level that playing field before I put them in together.
Okay.
So. You know, they're just pretty valuable animals, and they're both in a rack, so they're not even in a cage where I can, like, easily watch them. Yeah. So I think when I do try and breed them, I'm probably going to bring one of my, you know, plexiglass front cages into the house, put it in the living room, you know, and then put them together and see what happens so I can watch them while I watch TV. Well, I mean, I've got some horror stories. I used to try and breed ring pythons, man, and I had a female that was the meanest killer snake. She killed and ate three males before I finally just said, screw this, and sold her.
Oh, my God.
I just couldn't do it anymore. So
I didn't know
she was just
known for that kind of stuff.
she was just vicious mean. Now, there's a reason why a lot of guys don't breed them, because the, you know, generally you have a bigger female than the male, and the females a lot of times will attack and kill the males. And I just, mine killed three girls and ate them before I, that's it, I've had enough of this crap, and I sold her. And she was a beautiful female, but I couldn't get her to go. And she was just so big and so strong. They're amazingly strong animals, and she was so strong. Every time you, you know, put a male in there, she'd get one whiff of it and just crush the poor guy, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah, and Tom Keoghan told me once at Daytona, he said that his were a little bit prone to that, too, and what he would do is he'd put the male in with the female, and if she attacked him, he'd grab the ball of snakes and just dunk it in a bucket of ice water until she let him go. So,
wow.
Now, had I known that, that might have saved a life or two, but I didn't ever think to do that in the past. But, you know, and that's my fear with the blackheads, is I'm afraid that's going to happen. But, yeah, I hope to try next year. We'll see, because I'd love to produce some exempting blackheads. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be very cool. I don't know. I had a pair of California Kings, which I know are no blackheads or anything like that, but the girl ate the boy, and
yeah,
then she passed because she was trying to regurgitate him and choked.
Wow.
So, because I got a $200 pair of Cow Kings back then or something like that. Dude,
yeah.
Lost them. Like, oh,
well,
my
I think
God.
I think blackheads are just like giant Cow Kings. They've got that
yeah,
same
like,
crazy feeding response.
Yeah, and I'm
I mean,
nervous when I bring my Cow Kings.
I've seen my blackheads grab the side of the rack. Like, you open the door, and they'll come out, and if you move just the right way, they'll bite that lip on the rack and try and wrap it and hold on for, like, 10 minutes. And they're just grabbing plastic.
Wow.
And you're like, wow, man, that's just
wow.
You would eat anything. You know, I'm terrified to stick my hand in there. I mean, I have held them, and they're handling, but once they figure out you're, you know, a person, they don't generally try and eat you. But man, I mean, if I stick the soft end of a snake hook in there, same thing, man. They'll grab it, wrap it up tight, and I just have to leave them alone until they figure out it's not something to eat.
Yeah.
They're like giant Cow Kings. They've got the crazy feeding response like a Cow King does.
Yeah.
God, I don't want blackheads. I'm already nervous for my Cow Kings. Are you kidding me?
Oh, nice. They are a cool snake, though. But so as far as the carpet python market, what are your thoughts on what's going on with the carpet python market?
I don't know. I mean, what's going on with the economy, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know,
I think
for what we're doing, I think people are, you know, people are taking notice. People, when they go to shows, are seeing an awful lot of ball pythons. And I think there's an interesting thing that's happening in ball pythons is that in the next few years, you're going to start seeing a lot of animals on tables that have so many mutations mixed into them that even the breeder's not quite sure what's going on. And I think when that starts happening, prices are going to start coming down across the board. Because once you've got such a whacked out animal that you know everything that's in there, there's just a list of a possible list of stuff that's going on in there.
Uh-huh.
You know, prices are just going to come down a little bit. Carpet pythons aren't there yet. I don't think we're near that yet. You know, there's more stuff in Australia and in Europe that should start showing up here over the years. I think we're in a pretty good place. Now, carpets aren't ball pythons. I mean, they're not necessarily a great beginner snake like maybe a ball python is. But at the same time, you know, those of us who love them know, I mean, they're great display animals. For me, they're the perfect snake. They are generally pretty mellow. They're out and moving around, and they like to perch in branches and do all of the behavioral things that I love to see animals do. And, you know, just from that aspect, I think people are catching on, and they think that they're pretty cool. You know, I've got some pretty big-name guys who have called me in the past and said, you know, let me know if you produce this or that. You know, I want to play ball. You know, I think I want to start getting into some of this stuff. And, you know, I've got some ball pythons. I think I've got a couple dozen of them. I mean, you know, most everybody who does reptiles seriously has at least a few ball pythons. And I didn't pay really a dime for any of them. You know, I traded for all of them for carpet pythons because people wanted carpet.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, that's cool.
You know, and I've got some pretty cool stuff. So, and I ended up, you know, trading out for a lot of that. In fact, an interesting aside is, you know, most of the high end stuff that I have came because I made one large investment almost a decade ago on my Granite Jag project. You know, the guys over at Precision Reptiles, back then it was Soren and Ole. I think it's just Ole now, but Soren and I have got to be kind of friends, and I talked to him, and they had the only Granite Jag project on the planet, and they had a clutch of babies, and I talked him into selling me two pair, and I won't tell you what I spent, but it was a lot of money. It was a decade ago, and that's the one time that I had to go to my wife and say, please just trust me. You know, I know what I'm doing. I know you think that I'm crazy to want to spend this money, but we have the money. Let me spend it. I promise you in 3 or 4 years it'll pay off. And it really has. Most of the rest of the cool stuff that I have, and I have almost every other mutation that there is to have. Now, I've traded for most of that because of my Granite Jag project. I've been able to trade granites and trade Granite Jags for zebras, hexanthic blackheads, all kinds of cool stuff. So, you know, sometimes just making the investment on the right couple of animals can really pay off in spades. And, you know, I'm a really good example of that. I love to trade animals for animals if I think it's a good deal for me. And that's really where a lot of my stuff has come from. And it's put me in a position to do really well. My initial albino project, I traded just for, you know, large amounts of jaguars because I had a bunch of jags. And, you know, the person who had Chris Proctor called me up and said, "Man, I got some heads and possible heads. Do you want me?" And I said, "Man, I'll take all the females you got." And he said, "All right, I'll take X number of egg carpets," and I traded for everything, you know. And I to this day, I still have the entire group. I've got like 6 het and possible het albino females that are all breedable size now. So, and that was, you know, that was 3 years ago, but I traded for all of it. And, you know, it's been really good. And so you don't always have to have a lot of money to get involved. You just got to have something that people want. So, you know, if you can find the right species of the right mutation and get into it, you can find yourself in a pretty powerful position to be able to trade for some other pretty cool stuff.
Nice.
So, yeah.
It's cool that you mentioned Chris Proctor, because that's where I got my caramels from, my pair of caramels.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really kind of sad he left. He took a little bit of a beating over the pricing of his animals. And, you know, I think it kind of, you know, demotivated him a little bit. And I feel bad about that because I do consider him a friend. He got me into falconry. I'm a falconer. And I still have a hawk. In fact, he's out in the mews in the backyard right now. And he's
cool.
You know, he's a direct reason why I ended up doing that. He mentored me and told me everything I needed to learn and how to study. So I was kind of sad to see him go. And, you know, I guess the next, you know, question logically would be, you know, that he's a really good case study for that is, you know, and we're talking about carpet python market, is pricing. Man, I am not the guy to ask about that. And here's why. I'm not in the business of selling carpet pythons. This is a hobby for me. So I do it because it's fun. I will throw this mutation in with that mutation and see what I can get. I'm not doing it because I want to put my kids through college. I have a job and other businesses that take care of that. So pricing for me is not, you know, because I have respect for the guys who do this for a living, I don't go on Kingsnake and sell stuff at ridiculously low prices, you know.
Right.
I'm not a guy. I try and keep my market game face on. But when I go to a show and I've got a dozen zebras on my table and somebody's got, you know, a wad of $100 bills in their hand, you know, and they're wanting to negotiate, I will play ball. You know, I don't want a dozen zebra carpets 2 years from now.
Right.
You know,
right.
When I've got, you know, 15 or 20 jaguar carpets and, you know, I can sell them all for bucks a piece wholesale to somebody, I will do that in a minute. I'll do it in a minute because I'm not in the business of retailing snakes. It's not what I do. You know, and that's part of why I don't have a website. I really don't want to be the guy who's trying to get the most out of every animal. I don't have time. I hate it when people call me and say, "Can you send me a bunch of pictures of this snake?" I don't want to because I don't have time.
Right.
Anyway. But,
no.
And here's why. I don't mean to come across like a stuck-up pain, but I own 2 businesses. I've got, you know, 250, 300 snakes sometimes, depending on what part of baby season it is. I have 4 kids that are all involved in school and stuff like that. And my wife works every other weekend. So I'm a busy, busy guy. And I just, I can't be retail snake business. I do not have time. I just don't. So I'd rather sell 10 snakes to a guy, that, you know, for half price or, you know, 40%, not than sell one snake for full price. So when it comes to pricing, I try and stay off of King Snake so that I don't compete with the guys that are trying to get the maximum dollar. But, you know, I've made this point on the threads a couple of times, and, you know, I'll make it on the radio station, you know, with you guys now. Just, guys, if you've got a pair of snakes, no matter what it is, and you can recoup your investment in the first year selling the babies, just the first year, no matter what you sell the babies for every year after that, you're making a return on your money that most stock investors would cut their own nuts off for. Okay, so, so and I'm serious about that. I mean, if you think that you should be able to buy a zebra for $4,000 and 3 years later sell all the babies for $1,000 a piece, and if you're not able to do that, you should be pissed off, I say you're crazy. If you can sell them all for $300 or $400 a piece, make your money back on your initial purchase, and then make money off of that pair every year that they breed into the future, minus your cost of feeding them, which is, what, $1 a week?
Right.
You know, it's a crazy business that we're in. People sell snakes for $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 more than that sometimes. Do I think that's the same? No, because I've spent a lot of money on snakes. I want it really badly, but that's because I'm a hobbyist, and I love doing that. And sometimes people who love something will spend stupid money because they want it that bad.
That's
but
right.
at the end of the day, even if you're not getting what you think the animal's worth, you're probably still getting more than it's worth. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's a snake. For God's sake, it's a snake. And if you're getting that kind of return on your investment year over year, you're killing it. You're just killing it. And, you know, if you're being greedy and you think you're going to be the next millionaire breeding snakes, you know, you're probably not in it for the right reason. So, you know, that's why I'm not the pricing guy, because I don't think selling snakes for $4,000 or $5,000 on a regular basis, I just don't think there are that many guys out there that are willing to pay that. And, you know, especially for mutations like zebras and jags, it's a dominant mutation, man. I mean, these are not ball pythons. They're not producing 3 or 4 eggs a year. They're producing 12, 15, 24. But when you got 24 babies, normals and zebras, you should still be able to make a pile of money, even if you're selling them at low price. I mean, you should still be able to do really well. So do I think the future of the market is great? Yes. Even if the prices go down, you're insane to think that you shouldn't be doing carpet pythons, because people, there's a market for them. Even at lower prices, you're still going to make a pile of money. And,
Don't you think though, I don't know, maybe people will not like when I say this, but I always thought that when, you know, if you want to spend dooku money, which we all have, on snakes, it's sort of like you're, you know, being the guy at the beginning of the, you know, that you have it first, so to speak, and maybe put your name out there for it. But when it opens up and like with the jag now, the jag being, what, a couple hundred bucks maybe?
Yeah,
for certain
an average
ones
jag is $250, you know, it's for an average jag. For a really nice red jag, probably $600.
You're out of jags right now, right? Or almost out of jags, right?
Me?
You're almost sold out?
The only ones I have would be red jags.
I have 3 jags left.
Well, don't you think that at a reptile show, now that opens it up to more people to be able to, you know, I mean, they've always seen a jag and they're like, oh, you know, I always wanted one of them. And now, you know, more people are able to play, so to speak.
I've had customers come up to me and say like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to come back in a few months and drop the price. And usually I'm like, well, it's not really going to drop that quick. What do you got? Let's talk. You know, it's depends on what's going on. But you're right. There seems to be more people who are interested in certain morphs when they drop it to certain prices.
Right.
You reach different markets that way. There are people who don't want to spend that kind of money. There are people who are crazy enough to spend that kind of money. And then, you know.
For me, I'm always looking at stuff like, what's the snake going to be worth several years from now? And if I can get my money back first year and then make money year over year, a great example is like albino ball pythons. They're pretty cheap now.
Right.
$300, right? $350. You know. But it's a beautiful snake, and there will always be a market for those things. Now, if you produce 2, 3, 4 albinos a year from a given pair, and you're making $1,000 a year on that pair, and it's only costing you, what, $100 a year to take care of that pair?
Uh-huh.
You're making, what, a 900% return
it's pretty
year
good.
On that animal?
Right.
That ain't bad,
pretty good.
For a hobby. And that's for an animal that's really low priced. So, you know, I feel exactly the same way about carpets. For me, it's not about the money. And even at the lower prices, if you're new to the hobby and you've got to sell your stuff cheap, you're still making money in your first year, more often than not. If you're stupid and you go spend $4,000 on a snake that's worth $1,000, you know, and you don't make your money in the first year, you're still going to make your money after year 2, or at the worst after year 3. You know, now, is there risk involved? Yes. You could lose one of your animals if you don't know what you're doing. And, you know, but there's risk involved in any kind of investment. But there are people that kill themselves to make 12% on their money on the stock market every year. And we do this as a hobby. And even at low prices, you're getting hundreds of percents of return on the dollar for something that you love doing.
Yeah.
I don't understand why the guys get really mad that, oh my gosh, this guy killed the price. Well, you know, not really. He only has a certain amount of inventory, and once that inventory's gone, you know,
I guess I'm on the belief that, you know, it's like if you are going to do any kind of price dropping or anything like that, you should do it behind closed doors, so to speak.
Well, I agree with you there, Eric. I'm not going to go out and, you know, undercut guys. And here's a really good example. NARBC was just a couple weeks ago, and Blake and I were running a table together. And Blake was on the verge of selling, I think it was an IJ, to some folks, and we shared a table. And then they said, well, what about this Jag? And Blake said, well, that's his Jag. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll make you a great deal on that. And I threw a price out at him, like $150 or $175 for just a B grade, maybe a, you know, a C-plus grade Jag, just not a great one. And the guy's like, oh, I'll take that. Well, I think that guy, the buyer, assumed that Blake and I worked together. And I, you know, I ended up, you know, stealing the sale from Blake. So what did I do? I gave him half the money. I said, dude, $75. And he's like, you don't got to do that. I'm like, man, I just juked that sale right out from under you, man. It's not about the money for me. I'm doing it because I love to do it. It's just fun. And, you know, if you're the guy who's, you know, wanting to make $100,000 a year by selling $15,000 snakes, I think you're in it for the wrong reason to begin with. I really do. This is, you know, this is a hobby for me and for most other people, and even guys like Nick, and I've mentioned him several times, but it's only because we're really good friends. But, you know, he does it for a living. But, you know, I know Nick, and Nick's going to try and get as much as he can out of his animals. But you know what? He's a professional. He wrote a book. He's really well respected. Pretty much anybody in the country knows Nick is the guy for carpet pythons, specifically locality stuff. He put himself and worked himself into a market that he should charge what he asks for those animals because they're worth every penny.
Right.
I'm not Nick. I didn't write a book. You know, I've got a pretty cool forum, but I only advertise my animals in classifieds like everybody else. I don't have a banner ad on my forum, and I don't have a website. So when I sell animals, I'm wholesaling to guys who want to go out and retail, or I'm going to shows and selling for what I think is fair market value that day for that snake.
Right.
And, you know, just doing that as a hobby, guys like, you know, you and me, Eric, and Owen, you two, we can still do really, really well and not compete with those guys that do it professionally because they do more than you, you know. And, you know, I say that, Eric, but, you know, you're probably making a professional run at this and, you know, doing the radio program like you are. But you're putting in the hours and the extra work, so your animals are worth more because you're building a name for yourself. I don't have time to be a Nick Mutton or you or, you know, some of the other guys. I can't do it. I can't spread myself that thin. And so I'm the guy who's just kind of, you know, I've got some cool stuff, and I go to one or two shows a year, and that's it. That's how I move my stuff. And, you know, it works really well for me, and I'm super happy with the return that I get. And I think there are a lot of other guys out there that do exactly the same thing and should be happy that they're doing that, you know? I don't know too many other Americans that can make money on their hobby. I really don't.
Yeah. That's true.
We have a caller here, but this one looks like it's a legit one because it's actually a number. So let me see what happens here.
Something crazy.
Hey, caller with the 301 area code. Do you have a question for Sean?
Hey, Eric, it's Peter Jowles, your frequent caller.
Hey, what's up, man? How
you
doing?
Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, interesting conversation you guys are having, and it's something that you guys are talking about, something that really has me conflicted as far as profiteering in the hobby, because it seems like just from listening to your show, you know, you're Sean, who's a pure hobbyist who does some other stuff too. But, you know, listening to like Anthony Caponetto, I mean, I'm listening to it and you're just listening to a guy, to me, sounds just pure businessman. You know, I would never, I mean, I don't have anything bad to say about Anthony Caponetto, but I would never sit down and talk snakes with him because it's all about money to him. Then you have another guy like Justin Julander who, you know, just to listen to that guy talk about snakes and making the effort to go, you know, to go see them in Australia, stuff like that, is really into them. Now, I don't mean to trash Anthony Caponetto because the guy is a businessman. But that's what he is. It's different than someone who's into it for the snakes like Sean is. And that's why I say I'm conflicted, because without guys like Anthony Caponetto, and I don't mean him specifically, but without guys like Anthony Caponetto, we wouldn't have them in the hobby to begin with, you know? But
yeah.
So it's, you know, it's an interesting conversation. It definitely seems like there's two different kinds of people that keep the snakes. And that's why, personally, I can't stand ball pythons. Not ball pythons themselves. I can't stand what they've done to the hobby. For instance, when I used to breed a lot of colubrids, I got out of it. When somebody walked up, one of the reasons I got out of it was just one day I sat down and thought about it, because somebody walked up to me, didn't even say hi, and just said, "You got any bubblegum corns?" And I'm thinking, you know, why don't you start collecting baseball cards instead, you know? But I guess you could, you know, you could have this conversation with a lot of different snake guys, you know?
Right.
You know, Sean, your website's awesome. It seems like,
well,
it's growing leaps and bounds.
Before you go any further, the website is mine only because I bought it. Jim Karofsky should have all the credit for founding that site. I really haven't changed the look. I haven't changed the logo. I reorganized it, I think, to make it a little bit easier to kind of sort through. But other than that, Jim's really the guy. And, you know, if he ever gets to hear this, Jim, you know, we all owe you a bunch. And, you know, I appreciate you selling us the website, you know, collectively, because it's really been – you know, the storing house, the clearinghouse of all of the information that we've all been able to gather on this subspecies. And, you know, I think our website has no small part in the book that Justin and Nick just came out with. I mean, a lot of the stuff that they talk about has been theorized and hashed out on the pages of our forum. And that's a big kudos to everybody that goes there and works together. So I appreciate the comments on the forum, but I really like to send that off to Jim, because it's really, you know, he started the forum close to 15 years ago. And so it's really, you know, thanks to Jim that we're all here.
Yeah. Well, Sean, you know, that site has just gotten my perception, because I've gone on it over the years, but, you know, there's a lot more people on it now. Another thing, I don't know if you changed something in the past year or so, but it used to be extremely slow. Like, no matter where I was, when I went to your site, it would be slow to load.
We upgraded servers and we've upgraded the software. I've actually gotten pretty good at now. Whenever there's an update of the vBulletin software, we go with the new update. And, you know, I test it on a backup server first, and, you know, it runs a lot smoother. In fact, for those of you that are regulars, there's a new update now that's going to make it really Facebook friendly and, you know, YouTube friendly. And a lot of new features should be available with the new update that we're going to post up in the next couple of weeks. So,
yeah, Sean, back to what you were talking about as far as breeding and dumping on the market and things like that, one of the reasons I really don't like it is because it's exactly what you're saying. People get the snakes and they misrepresent them. And it's not necessarily that they might misrepresent them on purpose, but somebody gets a snake, it looks like an Irian Jaya, or it looks more like a jungle carpet or whatever, and it changes hands again. And then somebody sells it as a pure this or that, and you just don't know. And it's there's nothing you can do but talk about it, because there's nothing you can do about it now, you know. But as someone who's, you know, who's into it for the snakes, and, you know, is like you were talking, I was listening to you saying how you'd like to have you know, everything from Australia. You guys were talking about the old tellies and everything, but
hey, you want the whole collection,
right? But I mean, it's compromised, but. Like I said, I mean, there's nothing you can do except talk about it, because there's nothing you can do about it, because that's the way it is, you know. But
Right. Anyway. Well, and I know you were banging on Anthony a little bit, but, you know, it is guys like Anthony that, you know, the business side of it is why this is an industry and not just a bunch of hobbyists. So those guys all have a purpose also. I just, you know, and those guys are the guys that don't like guys like me who will, you know, breed a bunch of snakes and then cull the babies, because they see value in those babies and they want to sell. But that's, you know, I'm a businessman first. I own a couple of businesses and I understand what business is all about. And, you know, I understand the mentality for those guys. And a lot of them started off with a love of the animals, and then a lot of them still have that love. But at the end of the day, for them, their kids don't eat if they don't make enough money. And
that's a completely different motivator.
Than, you know, guys like you and I who are hobbyists. And I'm just lucky to be a hobbyist that's been doing this for a really long time. So I have a pretty big collection that I've got to make tough decisions on there every year. And, you know, that's just part of what I do. But it's either that and or I sell all the animals and hurt friends who, you know, are not, you know, hybridizers like me, or I get out of the hobby, which, man, I'm not going to do. I love it too much.
Sean, I know what you mean. You know, I did say that about Anthony, but I also said, you know, without guys like Anthony or Bushmaster Reptiles or some of the others, or, you know, we wouldn't have anything. So
Right.
I'm just saying that my snake interests are not parallel to Anthony's. Kevin, I have nothing in common with him as far as snakes because, I mean, he may be into snakes, but the snakes that can make him money. So, I don't mean to trash the guy. Honestly, I don't, because without him, I wouldn't have any. Without guys like him, I wouldn't have any. I'm just saying that it's just complete different motives, you know?
Yeah, we all have different motivators that drive us, for sure. And, you know, the big guys that are in the business are, you know, a lot of the reason why we're all here. But, you know, we're the customers, right? We're the guys who, you know, buy all the snakes and take them home and open the drawers and take pictures of them and post them on forums and go, hey, look at this, isn't this cool? And, you know, so we're the driving force behind those businesses. And, yeah, we've all got our different motivators. Look, Anthony and I don't get along on a lot of issues. In fact, you know, we rarely speak. I think the last time I talked to him was at a show 3 years ago, but that's because we have completely different views on, you know, how stuff should work. But look, the culling thing that we talked about earlier, and, you know, I appreciate you calling in and saying you sort of respect the opinion, because I've tried to throw that out on multiple forums, and generally I get, you know, whipped like an ugly dog. It's pretty, it's pretty brutal out there. But at the end of the day, I mean, there are an awful lot of these reptiles that we're all producing every year, and I have a very firm belief that
Sean?
A lot of them end up in really bad places and dying, you know, in neglectful homes because it was a really cheap goldfish in a bowl scenario where the kid takes the goldfish home from the fair and it dies 3 days later and gets flushed down the toilet. And if I'm selling $25 snakes and die slowly because somebody doesn't know what they're doing and they bought it on an impulse, I don't feel very good as a guy doing what I'm doing. I'd rather euthanize those animals quickly and use them as feeders than send them out into the marketplace to make an extra buck. And that's the difference between me, and that's why I see the value for hobbyists in culling. I just think it's smarter for us because we're not overproducing animals. You know, we're not sending animals out into a marketplace where ultimately at those low prices they're going to be sold to people that probably don't need to be keeping snakes in the first place. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's kind of harsh, but because, you know, everybody started off with a cheap snake. I did, and so did everybody else. But there will always be cheap snakes is my point. And too many cheap snakes, I think, is a bad thing. And, you know, look, we all feed rats. We all kill cows and eat hamburgers. I mean, animals eat other animals. And if you're responsibly culling by using stuff that you don't think is going to be valuable to the marketplace and to the hobby by using them as feeders, I think that's a great strategy for the hobby and for the future of what we're all doing. I really do.
Yeah. Hey, Sean, what was your MOS in the Marines?
I was an NBC NCO, Nuclear Biological Chemical Weapon.
Oh, you had to wear mop gear all the time?
Yeah, so I was the guy that got to run all you guys' gas chambers. The best job ever.
Oh, I was a combat engineer in the reserves. But, you had to go to Desert Storm. I actually was at Parris Island during Desert Storm, so I didn't have to go. But being in the reserves is a lot different now than it was then. Those guys are all going to war now, you know?
Yeah, so. That's why my tour was so long, because I was NBC, as those guys over there were struggling with chemical weapons depots. And because I was an MOS specific to that thing, instead of doing a year or less tour over there, I spent a couple of years. It was a pretty long, boring time. But, yeah, and I do feel bad. I feel like we kind of, you know, a lot of guys over there getting shot up now that, you know, we should have finished the job when we were there the first time, and we didn't. And that was probably the wise decision back then, but in hindsight, it may have been better just to finish what we started.
And that's a conversation for another time, and I think we should have just started bombing and kept bombing. But anyway, I don't want to talk about that. Anyway, hey, guys, I'll see you guys later. All right, thanks, Sean.
Thanks a lot.
Yep. All right. So I guess let's see. I kind of lost where we were at. Let's see. I was curious. Have you seen an increase in the amount of people coming to the forum?
Yeah. For a couple of reasons. You know, carpets are more popular. We're seeing an awful lot of newer folks coming. But also I forget the name of the site now, but I got to give them props. The Chad Brown from Pro Exotics and Robin over there got that that website that they're doing. That
Oh, the Reptile Report.
Yeah, the Reptile Report. They actually came by our table at the NARBC show and said, you know, you should let us forward people to your website. And I'm like, sure, man, I don't have a problem with that. And I got to say, it's really worked. Quite a few new people are checking out some of our, I don't want to say more controversial, but more interesting threads on the website. And, you know, we're all really lucky on the forum and that everybody's really cool. We don't have a lot of big fights, you know, on the forums a lot, which is one of the reasons that, you know, I love it so much there. And but the information is so valuable. And Robin has done a great job at finding some of these threads that even though they're a little bit older, it's just a lot of juicy stuff in there that if you want to learn about carpet pythons, it's just a lot of great information. And that alone, I think, has really sent a lot of folks to our website. But just the general, just guys like you, Eric, in the last 5 years, so many people have gone out, spent a little bit of money, spent a little bit of time, and pulled together decent collections that now people are coming to shows and going, holy cow, man, that's badass. You know, and I can't tell you how many people think a jungle carpet python is some kind of wicked cool mutation. You know, it's just a normal jungle. And you tell them, no, this is a normal jungle carpet python. And they're like, really? That's a normal? I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, and that's what's so great about what we do is unlike being stuck in this little ball python box, we've got all these subspecies and all these mutations within the subspecies, and then you've got the crosses of the mutations, and so many people are, you know, it's a little bit confusing for new people, for sure. It's difficult to explain the difference between the subspecies and the morph sometimes, because some morphs are called jungles, right? And that confuses people, but at the end of the day, it's been really exciting. I love to go to shows and talk carpet pythons. I really do. I spend more time educating than anything else. And one of the things that I do, by the way, that you know, maybe some other guys that are serious and have inventories that would support this is I give away a snake to somebody every show. And this last show I gave away a zebra.
Wow.
So what I mean by that is I always donate stuff to the auctions. I do that every year. But you know, I think the excitement in carpet pythons is it getting to a fever pitch? I don't know about that. There are just as many people that don't like them that like them. But more and more people are beginning to like them. And I'm finding more and more young people are coming up to my tables and going, you know, I saw this book or I read this article and I've been to your website and I love this species. You know, can you tell me a little bit about it? And, you know, they just can't quite afford it. But then I see them again on Sunday. And if that animal's still there and that kid's really into it, a lot of times I'll just give it to them. You know, I want them to get into these animals and come back in a year or two and go, man, I got that female. She's doing great. I really want a male now. You know, I think every once in a while, finding somebody young in particular that just really wants to get involved in the hobby, doesn't quite have the cash, it does us all a heck of a lot of good to get that guy started. Give him something that says, here, man, go. Have fun. Take this. Take pictures of it. Post it on the forum. Tell him you pay a lot of money for it. I don't care. But go take this animal, enjoy the hobby like, you know, I did when I was your age. You know, I'm 40, almost 42 years old now, and I've been doing this since I was a little kid, and I love it. And I can't tell you how hard I worked in my teenage years and how much I loved it on that import business. And I had some guy back then come to me and go, look, here, take this, you know, really cool snake, you know, and get started. I mowed lawns all summer to buy my first pair of corn snakes from a pet store. You know, when I was like 14 years old, and it's one of those things. It makes me feel really good. And at the end of the day, there's so many new people coming in that if you can help one of them out, if they can't quite make the purchase, and you know, it's not going to break your bank to just give one away. Give it away. Give that kid his first snake. Get him started so that 3 or 4 years from now, you know, when he's on Reptile Radio, he'll go, you know, I just want to thank these guys for helping me out, because if they hadn't given me that snake that day, I wouldn't be here today. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I think, you know, guys like us that are doing this on, you know, a pretty serious hobbyist or even a small business level should be doing is every once in a while, you know, find that kid who's really got the desire and go, here, man, run with this. Make something happen with it. I think it's cool. And, you know, giving's, you know, one of those blessings that, you know, makes you feel really good. And, you know, hey, I get to give away snakes, which is cool. And I do one at every show. And this last show I did for this redheaded kid who was just awesome. And he brought his mom to the NE. Auction to bid on zebra, and it got bid way up beyond what their budget was, and he was really disappointed and really bummed out, and he came by the show on Sunday, and I'm like, here, dude, pick one. Just take whichever one you want, except this one, that one's really badass. But you can take any of these others.
Wow, that's awesome. That really
you know,
is.
Wow.
But it's cool, and you know what? I'll see that kid next year, you know, and I'll see that kid 3 years from now or 4 years from now, and even if I don't, you know, who cares? He enjoyed a really cool snake for a couple years, and then he sold it, and made some money for college or whatever. And I think if we all do that every once in a while, it just does us a ton of good. So.
Awesome. That's great. Now, Sean, we got these are questions that I always enjoy hearing about. See what we all think here is. So, Sean, what is your favorite carpet species? Yeah, we
hands
make
down,
you pick one. That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I love them all, but hands down, I got to say, McCaffey. I love the Inlands, man. They're just cool. They don't look like
yeah.
any of the others. They don't get huge like a Brettle, so they're easier. They all seem to be really docile. You know, and every time I bring one to a show, the first question out of everybody's mouth is that an Xanthic? I mean, that's just how different they look. They just look
wow.
so different. And I love the combo of that steel blue-gray with the black and that, you know, chestnutty brown and the silver eye. The silver eyes, I just love them. And, you know, have I produced any yet? No. I really hope to produce some this year. But, you know, they're still relatively rare. But that really doesn't have anything to do with why I like them. I they're so different looking is, I think, why I like them the most. There's nothing that looks quite like an inland carpet python.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, what's your favorite carpet morph?
I'm going to go against the grain here and say granites.
Granite?
Yeah, I know a lot of people don't like them because they've got some hereditary issues that we're kind of working our way through right now. But at the end of the day, I've always been a fan of het traits because, again, I'm a hobbyist, and it's more about the hard stuff. I want to create the stuff that's hard to create because it makes it more fun when I finally hit it. And,
right.
you know, the granite stuff just takes longer to do. I mean, I'm going to produce an albino zebra before I produce an albino granite because making an albino granite is going to be a lot harder.
True.
You know, but that's why I like them. You know, the harder it is and the cooler it is when you finally make it. So, and, you know, if you look at granites across the other species, like granite berms and granite ball pythons, there's nothing like a granite carpet that is pixelated pattern from the tip of that animal's
nose. No, that is true.
To the tail. Berms have, you know, patternless spots on them that aren't quite granite. I don't know why they even bother to call granite ball pythons granites because I would call them freckled or something, but not granite. You know, but a granite carpet python, you know exactly why it's called that when you look at it, because it looks like
right.
a piece of granite, you know. And if I could get that color tone, that brown, black, tan, and yellow tone in a slab of granite, I'd put it in the, you know, in my kitchen. It's so pretty. It's just nice.
I'm waiting for Eric to breed his granite, because he's got that one girl that, you know, that's one of the reasons I think about going to his house and thumping him in the night and taking everything. But
yeah, I was lucky enough
one
to grab that one that Nick produced. This year?
Yeah.
You know that one? Yeah, that's nice. He's going to
yep.
regret selling that one, I'm telling you.
I can't wait until somebody produces an albino granite. I cannot wait. I think that's going to be the neatest looking snake in a long time, and it's going
to
take a while to
work.
Do. But,
yeah.
Or even
right,
an exanthic granite. An exanthic granite would be cool, too.
That would be
very
cool.
That.
I
yeah.
think
then you start adding jag into that kind of stuff. You get an exanthic granite jag.
Right.
I mean,
right. So working on it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I can't wait now.
I'm probably
right.
4 years away still, but I'm working on it.
4 years is closer than I am, so being that I own neither exanthic or granite, so now if you could have any Morelia in your collection, which would it be? Are we still sticking with Owen Pelly?
Well, you know, Owen Pelly is probably my favorite species of python that I would pick. But if you're going to ask me for Morelia specific stuff, I'd say Bolens. I'd really like to get some Bolens at some point. In fact,
yeah.
I want it on the record so everybody can hear me. Jason Balin, you guys had him on a while ago.
Yeah.
A couple shows prior, and I listened to that show, and he inferred a little bit that I've got a theory about why those things won't breed, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it now so that when someone does this and they successfully breed Bolens, I want credit. Okay?
Do it.
You know, I've talked to several people, and I actually pitched this to Mark Spataro years ago when I saw him in Daytona. I met him for the first time. He's a really great guy, by the way. And he's convinced that there's some dietary stuff going on with those things as to why you can't seem to get fertile clutches out of females. You know, the males are – you know, have, you know, fertile sperm and the females are ovulating, but then they're just, you know, I don't know if it's that they're throwing slugs or absorbing or both, but they're just not getting fertile eggs out of them. And a couple of occasions, and Jason talked a little bit about his, where these animals have had viable eggs have been really strange situations where the females were stuck in, like in Jason's situation, the animals we had were in these like tubs with no heat and just kind of stuck in these black holes for a couple of weeks before he got them or whatever. They were just basically in storage tubs, right? And I think the situation with the other captive breeding was very similar, where the animal was almost abused. You know, now we all are reptile people, and keeping an animal in a tub for a week or two isn't necessarily an abuse because that's typically how they're going to behave in the wild anyway. But, you know, just for the PETA people who are listening, you know.
Right.
Anyway.
They don't listen to us.
It seems like the successful breedings that have happened have all had something to do with an animal stuck in a tub or in a dark place for a long time. And, you know, the photos that stunned me the most or that impressed me the most that Mark had taken is he had a photo of a female on eggs in the wild. And, you know, she was down in a burrow surrounded by all of this plant matter and root balls and stuff like that. And he talked about how they live in these relatively small micro habitats where you can, you know, when you climb these jagged mountain peaks and you look down, you see a basking area where they've laid all these plants down flat because they bask in the same spot every time, and then they go hide in the same hole every night. And, you know, if they're finding eggs down in these holes and the fertile clutches or the few fertile, you know, captive babies that have actually, you know, bred and then hatched out in the captivity have come out of these tubs and these, you know, essentially plastic holes. Guys, how come nobody's doing burrows in their cages?
Right.
You know, why isn't somebody putting a 4-foot cage, you know, on top of another 4-foot cage, drilling a hole in the bottom and so that they can go down into the one on the bottom and sit in a giant vat of, you know, plant material or whatever and make them feel like they're in a burrow.
Blacked out, yeah.
Yeah, and nobody's doing that, and I don't know why they're not, because it seems to me like that's the one thing that's worked. So let's duplicate that, but I know Mark hasn't done that yet. I don't know if he's going to try it this year, and nobody else has done it. And I swear, I think that's all it's going to take, is you need to make that female, once she's gravid, feel comfortable. Put her down into a burrow and let her feel like she's in a naturally safe environment, and let nature take its course. I think when they're in the wide open cage and people are walking in front of the cage all the time, something's triggering in them where they're not going through with the process of, you know, creating fertile eggs and then laying the eggs. I really do think that's it. So I could be completely wrong, and guys that are working with Bolins, you know way more than me. I get it. But I am really good at observing animal behavior. I always have been. And I'm telling you, that seems like what's going on to me. Nobody's willing to put these things in a burrow after they, you know, are ovulated and see what happens. They all are just trying to do it in cages like carpet pythons, like we do, with maybe a nest box. And I just don't get that. I think you need to put a burrow beneath the existing cage where the heat source and the light source is and let them go down in there and hide. And I tell you, I think that's it. And so, guys, when you make that happen, those of you with Bolins pythons, you just have to say that you got the idea from me, and I will do it.
There you go. You had it.
That's all you want. Just a little bit of credit.
That's right.
All right, so, now
once that's figured out, I'd love to get some Bolins, but I'm for what they cost those, and for as hot as it gets here, I don't want to mess with them because it gets so hot. I think I'd end up killing them. I really do.
And then you never forgive yourself. At least I wouldn't.
I wouldn't either. So I think I'm probably going to stay away from them. I've got diamonds right now. I'm finally going to try diamonds and see how that goes. But in the summertime, I'm going to bring them inside because my snake room just gets too hot.
You have to.
Yeah.
Jeez. All right, now, what about a non-Morelia species?
Owen Pelly, again. I got my Owen Pelly. That would be the one. As an interesting aside, I'm not a giant snake fan, although I've had berms and stuff in the past. But with the way the laws have changed recently with the big snakes, I am seriously considering buying a very high-end pair of Burmese pythons. For the sole reason that I want babies so that 30 years from now or 25 years from now, when they're exceptionally rare, I've got some that are grandfathered in. And I know that's strange because they're so common right now, but I'm serious. I really think that things are going to continue to get worse for those animals. And, you know, we haven't seen anything yet. We saw them added to the Lacey Act, and now it's illegal to, you know, sell and transport, you know, over state lines. And I get all that. I think I just want to pick up a really nice high-end pair of berms so that I can say I've got them. I mean, maybe I'll go get a pair of fires so I can produce a leucistic. I don't know. I'd be willing to spend a little money just because I want to have them in 15 years when nobody else has got them.
Right.
You know, in case the laws change, A, but B, you know, Texas is a big state, and, you know, there probably would be a market for people within my state to purchase some, you know, decent berms every once in a while. So, but I don't know. Are they my favorite snake? No, but I think it's a real shame what's happened, and I'm afraid that without guys like me, they're going to disappear, you know, from the hobby completely, and I don't want to see that happen. And, you know, the reason I feel that way is so many species are have gotten really hard to find or have disappeared in reptiles, and I'm also a big fish guy. I used to breed killifish like crazy. It's one of my favorite species of fish is killifish, and so many animals that were available 2 decades ago are just completely gone from the hobby now because people, oh, well, I'm sure someone else will keep these, you know, and then one day they're gone.
Right.
You know, and I'm afraid that some of the bigger species, now that everybody's afraid of them, are going to eventually disappear. And, you know, as hard as that is to believe, that really is possible. And, you know, it, so much progress has been made with that species and all the different mutations that I hate for it all to go to waste just because everybody gets scared away. So I may pick up a pair of berms. So is it my favorite? No, but it's kind of what I'm considering right now.
Yeah. I have my albino Burmese. She's just a pet, but, you know, being that we're in Pennsylvania and, you know, if Pennsylvania, you know, if the laws keep changing, and I know people who are bailing out of Burmese personally who are trying to unload. At one point, my girl, she's a pretty big girl. All of a sudden, she now becomes, you know, one of the only big breeding females in Pennsylvania. It's like, oh,
right.
Okay,
right.
Well, all right, I guess it'll be something
right.
to add later. So... Oh.
Exactly right. So, you know, and there's a bunch of other stuff out there that I'd like to keep, but I think I'm going to keep my interests mostly in the Australian stuff. In fact, I've got an adult trio of Angolans right now. I think I'm probably going to sell because it just doesn't fit into the Australian theme of my room anymore. And they're so cool, and I've enjoyed breeding them in the past, and I'm going to try them one more time this season, but I think I'm just going to let them go because I can't keep everything. As much as I want to, I do have to keep it as a hobby. One day when I'm retired, you know, and I can afford to keep everything I want. Oh, I will. You know, I absolutely will. But I'm pretty much limited to my one room here at the house, and then I've managed to take over a storeroom up at the office. Some of my exits and overflow when I need it. In fact, thank you, Jake, for selling me all those cages. They worked out great. And
slowly but surely, you'll just move into other places. So.
Yeah, you know, I'm that guy. I mean, I really want to be, you know, gosh, what's the big ball python guy? I'm not a ball python dude, so, but I know exactly what I'm thinking of, and I can't remember his name now.
Rock the, Wagner?
No, the king of ball pythons. What's the guy's name? He's a construction guy.
Ralph Davis.
Ralph, yeah, Ralph. I've seen a bunch of his YouTube videos, and his snake room, I love it, because it's like a giant playroom. He's got all the snakes, you know, and then if you've ever seen some of the other videos, he's got his turtle pond in there, and a couple parrot cages with his parrots and all that just fun stuff, that's me. That would be totally me in retirement. I'd have all my cool animals all in a giant building that I could just go play with them and be happy as a clam and one day fall away from a heart attack and be completely happy. You know, that's
right. That's a good plan.
And there we go.
Let's see. What else do we have? Is there anything else you wanted to hit on? Because we're not live anymore, but we're still recording, so...
What time is it? I don't know how long we've been talking.
We're at 12 o'clock here.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've hit 2 hours. Yep.
I don't know. I mean, we hashed over a bunch of stuff. As far as the cool stuff we've got coming, I mean, it's, you know, the new and exciting inlands and maybe albino zebras. Everything else is going to be stuff that we've produced before. And the diamond jungles. I really, like I said, I want to give John a run for his money. So,
I don't know. I'm trickling into the world of jungle carpets, so eventually I'm going to have to just give you a call when it comes to those kind of things. So,
yeah, you know, I got to admit, the better lines that are out there are turning out some phenomenal animals. Like,
yeah, I know.
I don't know her personally, but I know you guys have had her on the show, and you probably knew her before that, but she's got some really cool stuff, and I know she got some of that from Battaglia, but, you know, it seems like, man, you start line breeding that stuff in the proper lines, and you can really come out with some stunning animals, and I can't argue with what I'm seeing. That just, it looks good, and I'm trying to, you know, necessarily compete, but I want some of that stuff, and I'm going to try and make it myself before I go buy it. mine don't look as cool. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to go buy some. So, so I can add it to, again, add it to the collection. But, yeah, the only thing I really don't have, and I don't think I'm going to produce for a while, is Xanthix. I waited a little bit on that one, and it just I didn't think they were that cool of a mutation until I saw the Atlantic Jag pictures like everybody else and went, ah, I should have bought those when I had the chance, you know. But I didn't, because I'm like, yeah, they're not that cool looking, you know. They look like, you know, a gray coastal. I see those all the time, and, you know, you clearly see the difference in some of the stuff that's being produced now. So, you know, kudos on those guys for getting ahead of me on that one. And I do have one head Xanthic female Jag now, but she's very small, and it'll be a few years before I can do anything with her. But I mean, I may buy a home with, I guess, male maybe in a year or so, if I can find one. They'll probably be pretty expensive, but
we might be able to trade something, Sean.
Maybe. I mean, hopefully. It's my favorite thing to do is trade stuff. In fact, you'll see me on Craigslist more in the barter section than you will in the sales section. I go on the barter side all the time and go, have carpet pythons, we'll trade four, giant question mark.
Right.
To see what people have. Cool. You know, and most of the time I say no, but every once in a while somebody throws something at me and I go, ooh, that's cool. In fact, anybody that's got monkey tail skinks right now, you want some carpet pythons, call me. I'd love to get some prehensile tail skinks. I really would. So, and I know Justin has some, and there are a few other people that have them. I really want some. I've owned hundreds of them when I owned that business of mine years ago, and I should have kept some and had some breeding groups, because that's just an animal that you don't see much anymore, and they're so cool. And I really think more people need to start breeding them in captivity, or, again, it's going to be one of those things that just disappears, and that one would be a real shame, in my opinion.
Right.
Well, they're very hard to find around here, because the Philadelphia Zoo does a breeding program. They have a whole room full of them.
Good.
So I guess it's I've talked with a few of the reptile curators and a few other things like that. I know a few of them, trying to see if maybe, you know, a baby could somehow go somewhere and end up in my basement, but they won't play ball.
They reproduce so slowly. That's my biggest concern about them, is I think the maximum they can have in a year is twins, like once, you know, a year.
Yeah.
But I'm not the guy who wants to have to cut up vegetables and stuff, but those are so cool that I would be willing to cut up the vegetables and the bananas and all that stuff every night. It's one of those pieces I've always dug. And, you know, they really were pretty available up until about five or 6 years ago, and now you can't find them anywhere. You know, and I think that just because they stopped importing them, and they may not ever import them ever again, and the few people that have them, they reproduce so slowly that it's just not one of those things you can get inexpensively anymore. And it's a real shame, because I'd like to get my hands on some now. But,
well, hopefully that'll change.
Okay. So, I guess what if somebody, I guess, let's see, what else? What if some, well, you don't have a website, so somebody wants to get in touch with you, would they go over to the forum and
most of the guys who know me, you know, Sean C. on the website, or you can just look up whoever the admin is and shoot me an email through there. You know, I see all the new registrations every day, because one of the requirements of registration now is you've got to shoot me an email so I can manually check you out and make sure you're a human being and not a bot. I don't know if you guys remember, we had some serious
fan
problems.
Oh, my God, it was terrible.
Yeah.
We finally figured out how to get around that, but it took a while. And now that we're past it, you know, I do see a bunch of people coming. So anybody that's new or, you know, wants to ask questions, you know, feel free to shoot me an email, you know, to the admin or just to Sean C. Or, you know, my email address is, you know, on the website clearly for everybody to see. And I'm a pretty easy guy to find. Like I said, I don't advertise a lot, and a lot of people don't even know I exist. But I do that on purpose. I really don't want to be the big business guy about this whole thing. I just like doing it.
Right.
You know, I'm happy to help people out and enjoy it as much as I do. So, yeah, you guys call me or email me or whatever. I'm around.
Well, I have to admit, Sean, I really enjoyed this show. I can feel your passion for the species, you know, just by what you're saying. And you really, I love the shows when we have the people on that really come across as really knowing what's going on with their animals and paying attention to that part of it, you know.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, I'm glad you guys started doing this too. I was a real reptile radio addict, and those guys have kind of petered way off to where they're not doing shows very often anymore. And my favorite fodder when I'm out in the snake room is listening to reptile shows like this.
Yeah,
so you guys kind of picked up where they left off. And not only did you pick up, but you picked up with my favorite species. So it's freaking awesome now. I've got entertaining stuff every week to listen to while I'm cleaning cages. It's great.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. Well, glad you enjoy it. Because that's pretty much how the show started. Because I was not really a ball python guy, but you know, it was just cool to hear guys talking snakes, you know, and genetics and breeding and all that kind of stuff. And I just sort of applied what they did to the carpet pythons, and seems to be working so far. So
seems to be.
Yeah.
I just came on because Eric's like, I need a co-host, and I'm like, I had to live close. Why the hell not? So you know.
Yeah. Well, you got to admit, it sounds like it's hella fun. I mean, it sounds like you guys are having a blast every time you do it.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I would have fun with it too. I'm sure if I could manage to do something like that, more power to you guys, man. I don't know how you work it into your daily schedule because it's got to be a ton of work.
Oh yeah, it is.
Yeah, Eric does most of it. I just kind of show up and, you know, make fun of him, but it's cool.
It really is, but you know what? I think in the long term, I think for the hobby, it'll be worth it because I think they're going to be archived, and, you know, it's sort of like the forum, but in a different version, you know, and you can hear these different breeders and get different techniques, and, you know, and one of the cool things that I think is, you know, and this I learned from Reptile Radio is that, you know, everybody does things differently, but the most important thing is you figure out what's going on with your snakes, and maybe you try this one thing and it doesn't work, and then you try something, you know, I tried something Nick said and it didn't work for me, so I tried something Sean said and that works for me for whatever reason,
right.
It did, you know, and then I have success, and I think that, you know, that's sort of the whole idea of it, and
yeah,
you know,
it's crazy. Depending on where you live and the climates and all that, even though we're working with the same animals, what works for me in my hot, dry climate down here isn't necessarily what's going to work for, you know, someone in the Northeast. You know, it does vary quite a bit. In fact, Jake, the guy who sold me all those cages, they were all his carpet python cages, but he couldn't get his carpets to breed worth a darn where he lived up in, you know, Nebraska. And he finally was like, look, man, just buy all these cages. I'm going to do nothing but ball pythons because they breed like crazy for me. Interesting subject. I have lots of ball pythons. I don't know what the hell I'm doing with those things. They're supposed to be really easy to breed. Tell that to my animal. I can't get them to lay eggs. So, you know, and, you know, Nick's really frustrated with me because he sent me a couple animals 2 years ago, and I'm, like, still trying to get eggs out of them. And I blamed it last year on, oh, well, you know, we just shipped them, and they're probably a little worked up. We'll give them a year to settle in. Well, you know, here we are a year later, and I'm still, like, looking for those eggs. Right, I got to make something happen here. I'm going to look like a complete tool, but, you know, it's just not working out. So it really is funny. I think sometimes, you know, depending on what you're used to doing with your animals and where you live, it can have a lot of effect on your success with them. I have a lot of success with carpet pythons, and I'm a real minimalist with them on purpose, just because I've got so many. And the ball pythons, I clearly cannot treat them the same way because they do not like it. They want to be pampered because I can't get them to ovulate and lay eggs. Now, I think I'm going to have a better season this year, but this is 3 years of trying. This is my third year. So, but I'm just not having any luck with them. And so it is weird, and it's interesting that you brought that up because I really do think where you live and what you're doing in those climates has a lot to do with your success. And just because something's not working doesn't mean there's not other people that, you know, can't give you advice, because even though it sounds crazy, it might just work. Hey, I don't use nest boxes in my cages, and most everybody else does, and I produce a lot of eggs every year. So it works for me. So I don't change it if it isn't broke. So
absolutely.
Awesome.
All right, guys. I feel like I'm talking your ear off, so.
No, it was, like I said, nice having you on, and, you know, you're welcome anytime, and, you know, hopefully when you hatch out that albino zebra, you can come on and, you know, let us know what it looks like.
Can I make a request?
Sure.
The next time, you guys, I don't know if you're even capable of doing this, but can you have more than one person call in?
Yes.
Of course.
You got to have Nick and I on at the same time and let us battle it out a little bit.
Dear God, yes.
We're complete polar opposites as far as what our views are of the hobby. So, you know, we're again, great friends, and I respect him and he respects me, but we do definitely disagree and do stuff different. And we love to beat each other up over that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, like you right. and you and Nick are like me and Owen.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we're like completely opposite, but we still somehow seem to get along real well. So, good. Yeah, absolutely. I would love to do that. You know,
that'd
I'll check
cool.
out the schedule and get with you guys. That would be an awesome show.
We have to slate like a 4-hour show. Oh, my God.
Yeah, between the two of us, it could get pretty bad, for
yeah.
sure.
That would be awesome. Absolutely. So, okay,
all right,
so.
Guys.
Thanks for coming on, John.
Yeah, thanks
no
for
problem,
coming on,
y'all.
John.
You
great
guys have a good
you.
Night.
You
yep,
too.
You guys have an awesome night.
You too, Sean. All right, Owen. That was a pretty cool show. Had
yeah.
a blast. You know, I love those type of shows. I love how they
the information that we keep gathering is awesome. It's always very cool to see views from different angles and different things, even if you might not agree with some of them.
Absolutely.
You know, it's definitely very cool to see what's going on and see what's happening with the breeders. We've talked to a lot of breeders. I mean,
yeah.
We've been talking, talking years off with a bunch of different things. It's very cool to know and have conversations with some of these big guys that when, you know, I first started getting into carbivores, I'm like, oh, God, you know, they have the biggest, best collection in. You know, I have to ask them questions would be great, and so. But
like
not,
talking
oh.
to the, yeah, talking to rock stars. You know what I mean? Like.
Yeah. Very cool. Now that we've inflated everybody who has been on the show's ego, let's
yeah.
move forward. What's going on next week?
Okay, next week we have. Next week's the 17th. We have Josh Easter coming on, and he's going to be talking diamonds. Diamond pythons and bowling pythons. He keeps bowling
awesome.
Too. And he
cool.
is a big maternal incubation guy.
Yeah. Okay.
He doesn't fire 50, up 50, it.
50, it's all right.
Yeah, I've seen the post.
No. I don't care about maternal incubation. What have we learned? We have learned that even if you're going to do maternal incubation, test
the
freaking incubator.
Yes, it's true.
Just make sure it's working.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would agree with you 100%. you know, but he has some unorthodox ways of thinking, and they're usually the shows that I really like a lot, you know, because it
yeah.
sort of pushes the envelope a bit. So I'm looking forward to talking to him and see what he's got going on.
Yeah.
And then after him,
yeah.
after him we have Wayne. He goes by Wayne Larks. But he's from
okay.
Australia.
Oh, my God.
So, no, I'm sorry. He's the 31st. And before that, we have, I haven't quite sealed up the deal with that guest. But on the 31st, we have Wayne coming on, and he's from Australia. So I'm really, really looking forward to talking from somebody down there and,
yeah.
and you know, somebody that can just walk out the door and find themselves some carpet pythons will be
would be awesome.
And then when we start in April, we go up north, and again, I have to get clarification on this, but Don Patterson.
Awesome.
He's coming on, and he deals with a lot of different types of pythons, and, you know, carpets being one of them. I know he was chasing that albino granite way back when he was on Reptile Radio, so I don't know how close he is to that project, but that'll be
Toby's cool, pretty close. He's also got those he's got that one living leucistic or something like that, or?
Yeah. No.
That's
a different guy.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Sorry. I have no idea what I'm speaking about. But
Don's a cool guy. And then, maybe in April, hopefully I can work it out with Nick and Sean, and, you know, maybe we can get that going.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that
Battle
would be cool.
Royale. Oh, yeah. It'd be great. No, we'll definitely figure that out. And
as far as the, I want to just make sure that I get the Carpet Fest out there. Keep pushing that. Remember, by the end of the month, we want a final count on how many people are going to be attending. Me and Howard were talking about different things this week, and I'll have to touch base with you, Owen, at another point. But you know, just trying to work out the details of everything and trying to organize it. And we're really trying to make this something that's cool that hopefully we can do every year. And then hopefully at some point, maybe we can do a national type of event. In the carpet python community, I think that would be really, really cool.
It would be.
Our Carpet Fest, the Northeast one, is happening May 12th, and it's hosted by Howard Redding from Redding Reptile Breeders. He's opened up his house and to let us in, and don't forget we're going to be doing the auction for U.S. ARC, and I don't know where we're sitting at as far as who else we're going to be donating, but I know some of the other donations might be going to the Morelia Forums, Morelia Python Forums, to see what we can do to help Sean out with that. We're getting people to donate animals. I know Peter, he made some snake boxes.
I did see those. They were fantastic looking.
Yep. People are going to be donating shirts and, all those things. We're looking for a range of items are going to be in there. I know I'm going to be donating a pair of those Irian Jayas I just hatched out. So if you're looking for Jayas.
I'm going to be donating a whole clutch of zebras crossed with red tigers. I'm sorry, Zebra Jags crossed with Red Tigers, a whole clutch.
Wow, Owen, you are a swell guy. You are such a nice person. You are so generous. I'm so glad that I have you on this show because I don't know. You open up your incubator to me and then you're just donating these high-end animals. I got a tear in my eye.
You're going to be slashing the days until those eggs hatch and I no longer have them here.
Yeah.
Because eventually it's going to get annoying.
Yeah. You got to love it. It's all in good fun. But I want to make sure that I give Howard all the props for letting us use his house. But he's going to be – and actually he's going to be there with Jason Balin and Mo – from Mojo Reptiles and Jason from East Coast Serpents. They're going to be at the Richmond Reptile Show, and that's tomorrow. So if you're anywhere near that area, go check them out.
Yeah.
The three of them sort of do their own little, carpet python tables thing going
Maryland, on. Maryland, was it good? The Maryland Morelia Mafia is what they call themselves, which,
that's it.
If we're going to start breaking up into states, you and I have to figure out what we're going to call ourselves. So,
true. but they're going to be
that's
there.
Later.
The Richmond Reptile Show, and that's tomorrow. And then they're going to Howard and I think Jason is going to be there at Tinley on the 17th and 18th.
Yep.
And Howard is also at the All Maryland Reptile Show on April 14th, and he will be at Hamburg on April 28th.
Hamburg is with he's going to be there with Jason. He's going to be there. Moe's going to be there on Hamburg, and I'm going to be there at Hamburg.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So there's going to be quite a few carpet guys girl. If you're looking for some carpet pythons, make sure you go.
If all their tables combined, yeah.
Check their tables out. What else do I got? Just make sure you, if you want to go over to the website, Morelia Python Radio, the Google site, if you just Google Morelia Python Radio, it'll come up. Owen's bio's up there and his new up there, so you can check that out. Check us out on Facebook. Make sure you like us. And also, make sure you check out Morelia Python Forums. Make sure you go over there, join it up if you're not a member, and check out all the wealth of information as far as Morelia that's over there. And usually we do a chat session on Saturdays. We sort of fell off a little bit with that. I know we were chatting a little bit tonight, but go over there, join up, get in the chat session. Chat session. As the show's going on, and,
you can ask questions of the guests, of us, things like that. We check that regularly, so it's another way to get a question that you might have that you don't really feel like calling in or something like that.
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all I got. What do you got, Owen? Anything else?
The only thing I got is you guys can check us out at Facebook. Just type in Rogue Reptiles. You see all the really cool products that we got going on, as well as the new species that we've got and kind of folded into Rogue. A couple liasses. Got a female maclots for the boy you gave me.
Oh, cool.
She hates my guts. Oh, my God.
Nice.
She's a spitfire. Anyway, also we've got other projects that we're getting into. It's like Facebook Rogue Reptiles. Also, you can check us out at rogue-reptiles.com.
Okay.
That's all I got.
All right. I just want to send out a thank you again to Sean for coming on and having a good talk with us. And look forward to the show next week. And to everybody out there, have a good night. And see you next week, Owen.
Yep. Everybody, good night. And we'll see everybody here next week.
Very good.
All right.